hop on board for a serendipitous musical journey as we create a playlist of 5 tracks.
The new series of Add to Playlist.
On Friday nights at 7:15.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 17th of November. This is Today with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning, the headlines today. The Home Secretary wants to change human rights laws to make it easier to deport failed asylum seekers. We'll discuss the plan for sweeping changes to the asylum system with the minister responsible and the former Supreme Court Judge Lord Sumption. President Trump has U-turned on the Epstein files. He's now urging Republicans in Congress to release them. A senior House Republican on the committee tells us why.
He realized that the press was solely going to focus on this until everything was released, and so that's what he's doing.
Also in today's programme, the UN's aid chief on the crisis facing Sudan and his call for Western governments to do more.
All I'm asking is 1% of what the world spends on defence, and we can really stand up a decent response to these crises. It infuriates me that we're seeing so many cuts and that the public's not out there demanding greater generosity.
We'll hear from parents arrested for making complaints about their daughter's school who've won damages from the police, and why just 1 in 3 children now say they enjoy reading in their spare time.
I wrote to the zoo to send me a pet. They sent me an elephant, but he was too big. Well done.
A classic, Dear Zoo. We'll ask what can be done to reverse the trend. Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Human rights laws are to be changed as part of the government's overhaul of the asylum system, with new measures introduced to make it easier to deport illegal migrants. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, will set out a raft of new policies in the House of Commons this afternoon. She said that tackling illegal migration is a moral mission, but the plans are likely to meet with opposition from within Labour. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
Shabana Mahmood wants to change how Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights is applied in migration court cases. It protects the right to family life, but the government wants it to apply only to close family, such as parents or children. Ministers hope the reforms will make deportations easier. The Home Secretary also plans to change the law, so those refused asylum can't make multiple appeals. There is already some scepticism about these sweeping changes. One Labour MP has told the BBC these plans are a step too far. Another said they had big reservations. Both the Conservatives and Reform UK have expressed doubts as to whether the plans will ever get through the Commons.
President Trump has called on Republicans in the lower house of Congress to release government files on the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein in a change from his previous position. Mr. Trump has come under pressure from within his own Republican Party to release the files, something he said he would do when he was campaigning for the White House. The president has been posting on social media, as Tom Simons reports.
Donald Trump said, "We have nothing to hide, and Republicans in the House of Representatives should vote to release the files." The House Oversight Committee is investigating the US federal government's handling of the Epstein case. Mr. Trump said, "It should have whatever it's legally entitled to. I don't care," he posted in capitals. It's a reversal of position as, slowly but surely, the political tide turns in favour of full disclosure of the files. The Democrats on the Oversight Committee published selected emails mentioning Donald Trump last week. The House is preparing to vote on a bill which would result in everything being released. Yesterday, a co-sponsor of the bill said 100 members of the president's own party could now back it.
The United States has said it will declare the Venezuelan criminal group, Cartel de los Soles, a foreign terrorist organisation. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said President Nicolas Maduro was the group's leader, which he denies. There's been speculation that the US might attack Venezuela as part of its military operation in the region against drug traffickers. A court in Bangladesh is due to give its verdict shortly on whether the former Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, is guilty of crimes against humanity. She was deposed after a wave of student-led protests last year and is now in exile in India. There's tight security across Bangladesh in preparation for the verdict, with checkpoints in place, and a number of crude bombs have been found in recent hours. From Dhaka, Arunade Mukherjee reports.
There are rows of armed security personnel and riot police standing guard outside the International Crimes Tribunal from where the verdict will be pronounced. Driving around Dhaka, we spotted a few police checkpoints close to government offices. Police say dozens of supporters of Sheikh Hasina's Awami League party have been detained on suspicion of planning to cause unrest. Prosecutors have sought the death penalty for the former Prime Minister, alleging the police action against protesters last year was carried out on her orders. The deposed leader denies all charges relating to the crackdown in which the UN says hundreds were killed.
A couple from Hertfordshire who were arrested in January after making complaints about their daughter's primary school on a WhatsApp group say police have paid them damages. Hertfordshire police said at the time the arrests were necessary to investigate allegations of harassment and malicious communications. Duncan Kennedy reports.
Maxie Allen and his partner Rosalind Levine from Boreham Wood told The Times six officers came to arrest them and that they were held for 11 hours. According to the paper, the dispute had arisen after the couple had been banned from entering the Cowley Hill Primary School as they questioned the recruitment process for a head teacher and criticised the school's leadership in a parents' WhatsApp group. The couple admitted emailing the school regularly but said it was to discuss their daughter's special needs. Ms Levine told the BBC that the police had now admitted liability for unlawful arrest and paid them £20,000 in damages.
Powerful farming interests in Brazil are pushing to overturn a long-standing policy which has been credited with limiting deforestation. They want to scrap a voluntary agreement which bars the sale of soya grown on land which was cleared after 2008. Environmental groups say that would be a disaster, as our climate editor Justin Rolat reports from Brazil.
Soya is a key ingredient of many animal feeds, and about 10% of the soya used in the UK is from the Brazilian Amazon. The almost two-decade-old ban on buying soya from newly deforested land is widely credited with having stopped huge areas of virgin forest being felled. Major UK food companies, including Tesco, Sainsbury's, McDonald's and KFC, support the ban. But some Brazilian agribusiness groups argue it creates an unfair cartel and have redoubled their efforts to have it overturned.
Technology, which was originally developed for Formula One cars, is being used to try to improve Wi-Fi on trains. A 60-day pilot scheme on a Great Western Railway intercity service will test a hybrid system that draws signals from both phone masts and satellites to create a much faster and more reliable onboard connection.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 7 minutes past six now after a weekend of miserable weather. Might be hoping for respite, but Simon King, some of us are watching for snow now.
Absolutely, Anna. Yes, snow is in the forecast, particularly for Tuesday and Wednesday. So stay tuned to the forecasts. But certainly you'll all notice something a bit colder through this week after what's been a very mild start to November. Certainly this morning, we start off on a rather chilly note, a touch of frost in places. But for southeast England, eastern and northeast England, we've got some showers on coastal areas. So some of those showers will work their way a bit further inland, but for most, it's going to be dry. There'll be some sunshine through today as well, but a brisk northerly wind will make it feel quite chilly, and maximum temperatures getting up to about 7 to 10 degrees. In southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northwest England, it's a cold start. As I said, a touch of frost in places, particularly the northwest. Dry though, with some clear spells for most, and that will translate into some sunshine, which is going to last all day. Highs of 5 to 9 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, it's a chilly start, a dry start though. Lots of sunshine expected today, but there will be a bit more cloud increasing later this afternoon, highs of 6 to 8 degrees. And for Scotland, well, we've got a frost first thing this morning, especially in southwest Scotland. Dry, though, with some sunny spells for most. Some wintry showers, though, coming into the north and the east of Scotland today on a rather brisk to strong northerly wind, especially around eastern Scotland. Cloud will start to increase in the north and the west later this afternoon, highs of 3 to 7 degrees. And that cloud around Northern Ireland, Western Scotland, will also bring a bit of rain and some hill snow to Western Scotland through this evening and tonight as it spreads away a bit further south and eastward.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. It is 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Guardian says the Home Secretary's plans to overhaul the asylum system have prompted significant unease amongst senior Labour aides and ministers, with at least one on resignation watch. Party insiders have told the I newspaper that the success or otherwise of the changes will determine whether or not Labour wins the next general election. The Times describes the plans as a significant escalation of government action against illegal immigration, but the Mail claims that Labour backbenchers and left-wing lawyers are poised to defeat them.
The Sun's editorial also sounds a note of scepticism about the likely success of Shabana Mahmood's plans. It says they are doomed to failure unless she takes the only step that deep down she must know will end the crisis, quitting the flawed and outdated European Convention on Human Rights. The Daily Telegraph focuses on the government's plan to stop issuing UK visas to people from three African countries which refuse to take back failed asylum seekers. The paper says the ban mirrors a policy introduced by Donald Trump and could in the future be applied to Iran, Bangladesh and Somalia.
There's still plenty of pre-budget speculation. The Times claims a new tax will be levied on tourists, which will allow metropolitan mayors to raise hundreds of millions of pounds for local services. The Telegraph claims a tax on milkshakes is being lined up to make the public healthier, and the FT thinks online sports gambling is in the Chancellor's sights, but says that horse racing will be exempted.
This morning's Mirror says that all plaques bearing the name of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor have been removed from the Falkland Islands. It says he was once hailed as a hero there, but has now been erased because of his links to the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein.
The Times thinks there are signs that striking resident doctors in England are turning against their union, the BMA. It quotes a letter to hospital chiefs from NHS chief executives, which says there have been fewer doctors striking in this walkout than any of the 12 previous rounds of industrial action. The BMA has said striking is a last resort.
11 minutes past six now. The US is going to designate an alleged Venezuelan drug cartel as a foreign terrorist organisation. And this is notable because it's claimed to have links with major figures from the government, including with President Nicolas Maduro. Well, President Trump spoke to reporters from a Florida airport before boarding Air Force One back to Washington.
We may be having some discussions with Maduro. And we'll see how that turns out. They would like to talk.
Well, our South America correspondent Ione Wells told me that this all fits in with the US military buildup that's been happening in the Caribbean.
The US has sent this huge military deployment to the Caribbean in recent weeks, including now the world's largest warship, which is essentially a kind of floating airport, really. They've sent bomber planes, spy planes, thousands of troops, warships, just to name a couple of things. And the US has carried out at least 21 strikes so far on alleged drug trafficking vessels, killing at least 83 people. But this intense military build-up all seems a bit much for an operation that the US says is about targeting these relatively small drug trafficking vessels, something that's normally in the remit of coast guards. And that's why many observers here in the region believe that this is also about putting military pressure on Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro himself to leave office, or on those around him, for example, in the military, to oust him. It's no secret that many in the US government want that for a combination of reasons. They accuse Venezuela of not doing enough to tackle cartel activity, drug trafficking, Venezuelan migration to the US, the fact that the US doesn't recognise Nicolas Maduro as the legitimate president of the country after last year's elections were dismissed widely internationally as neither free nor fair. So there's a number of different reasons why the US wants him to go. And I think that is largely the assumption about why they are building up such a strong military force in the region.
And now we see, feeding into that, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio announcing that the Cartel de los Soles will now be considered a foreign terrorist organisation.
That's right. He said that from the 24th of November, the US intends to designate the Cartel de los Soles as a terrorist organisation. Now, it isn't a cartel in the traditional sense. It's a name that the US uses to describe an alleged criminal organisation involved in activities like drug trafficking. Washington claims that this group is led by President Nicolas Maduro and members of his inner circle. Maduro has always strongly denied this, and the US has never published evidence publicly of Maduro's direct involvement in any drug trafficking. But it's why it's really significant Because the US is essentially characterising Maduro as a drug trafficker, essentially giving itself licence, I think, to target him or those close to him as part of what it's described as its wider military campaign against alleged narco-trafficking. So by designating the Cartel de los Soles as a terrorist organisation, the US would effectively be designating President Maduro himself as a terrorist. And that's significant because it would allow the US government to crack down more aggressively on the group and its alleged associates, making it illegal to offer them any support. And as I say, this comes as speculation has been mounting for weeks now about whether the US may be looking to strike land targets inside Venezuela itself. So far, Donald Trump has said he has, in his words, sort of decided what he wants to do, but in a typically quite vague way. So the US's move is still really quite unclear.
Ione Wells, thank you.
It's now 6:15. The parents who were arrested by six uniformed police officers at their house after complaining about their school's or their daughter's school on WhatsApp have received a payout for wrongful arrest. Our correspondent Tom Simons is following this story for us. It generated huge controversy, Tom, didn't it?
It did. Maxi Allen and Rosalind Levine posted on one of those school WhatsApp groups we know and love, and it developed into a prolonged criticism, really, of Cowley Hill Primary. Last June, the school complained to the police, and earlier this year, Maxi and Rosalind were arrested and held for some time on suspicion of harassment and malicious communications. Now, the police have now accepted there was no case and each are going to be paid £10,000 in compensation. The police are saying that the legal criteria for these offences, harassment, malicious communication, weren't met. But they're saying there was no misconduct by the officers. They stood by their decision to investigate, and they said that as a result, they consider the matter closed.
It isn't closed for this reason, is it? Which is, it's seen by critics as being part of a pattern of police overreach.
Yeah, a police overreach where the police are effectively policing hurtful words, I think the phrase would probably be. I mean, let's look at the case law. So for harassment, you have to prove that there's oppressive, unreasonable posts that produce alarm and distress. And for malicious communication, they must be sort of grossly offensive. So the police are saying the messages weren't that, they didn't meet that bar. There's no suggestion that they were abusive, for example. But I think there are two factors here. It's a bit like the case where Alison Pearson, the Telegraph columnist, was questioned by police about a tweet where she was accused of inciting racial hatred against a group of Pakistani men. In that case, the police again said, we're just investigating. But often the people under investigation aren't given very much detail about why they're under investigation. And it all seems very unfair. And when, of course, it comes to the end of the investigation and the police think, we haven't met the bar for there to be a charge here, well, then you can see why people suggest that this is a effectively policing of free speech.
And it did not help the police that they were arresting somebody who worked for The Times, who then, of course,
indeed, Nick,
produced the story. And we're going to hear from him, Maxi Allen, also from his partner, Rosalind Levine, later in the programme in about an hour's time. Tom Simons, thank you.
17 minutes past six now. Last week was a bit of a gloomy one when it came to the economy, with data showing that GDP was down in September. But this week, we are starting with a bit of good news about how British companies are trading around the world. Felicity Hannah's got more on that and the rest of the day's business news as well. Morning, Fliss.
Morning. Yes, definitely some good news. UK exporters have had a strong third quarter, particularly those in financial services and manufacturing. This is according to the UK Trade Barometer. Now, that is a survey of over 2,000 firms across the UK, conducted by Manchester Airports Group. And that group owns and operates not just Manchester Airport, but also Stansted and East Midlands as well. So let's talk to its Chief Strategy Officer, Andrew McMillan, joins me now. Andrew, good morning. 55% of exporters said they increased global sales in that period between July and September. That's up slightly on the last quarter. What's behind that increase?
Yeah, well, we found three things in the survey, as you said, of about 2,000 firms. The first was that optimism, and just that sense, maybe it's resilience is another word for it, that you're finding more than half of exporters selling more into an existing market and over a third, 39% into a new market. And they're feeling optimistic going forward as well. So there's just firms feeling like they can do this. I think the second thing you're seeing is diversification. What we're seeing is British firms very nimbly, very flexibly finding a route to growth. So at the beginning of the year when we did the survey, Something like 29% of firms were selling more each quarter into the US, and that's come down. It's now only about 23%, and only about 13% of firms were actually looking to sell into a new market in the US. But what we've seen is that just the spread of countries that they've gone to, so places like Australia, the big EU markets, some of the big markets in Asia, so real spread and diversification happening. I think the third thing you're seeing is that you do see divergence between industries and between regions. So you mentioned financial services up quite a lot, construction, manufacturing, which is quite encouraging to see, up 6% in terms of firms selling into existing markets. But also a big split between regions. We find in the survey that London businesses tend to sell more. So well over 2/3 of them increased sales into existing markets. Mm. But you have a bit of a gap, for example, with the north, and we serve all of the country, something like 70% of the population is within 2 hours of one of our airports. And in north, it's probably about 10 percentage points or more lower. But what we have seen is a bit of that gap closing over time. So that's another thing that's encouraging to see in terms of the trade performance.
Well, that's good to know. But it's also interesting. You talk there about, you touched on the US tariffs. Very, very hard to talk about trade without thinking about those at the moment, isn't it? Because we saw data last week that exports to America had hit their lowest level for more than 3.5 years in September. Presumably, you are seeing the impact of those tariffs on the businesses that you speak to.
I think what you can see in the survey, yes, is the impact of volatility around the world. Where it's not all about tariffs, of course, it's about a range of factors, which means that businesses can either find it harder or easier to sell into different markets. And what you see is, again, just that flexibility and that resilience of British exporters. We're really good at many of the things we do, and in those sectors, we're very strong. But the key thing, I think, is that, it's not just tariffs. It is about the connectivity you have. Can you actually reach these markets? Mm. Can you get your customers to come to you? It's about your ability to have a cluster and a kind of a critical mass in an area of the businesses that drives the talent, the innovation, and the investment that you need. So if we see that, for example, with life sciences around, say, Stansted and Cambridge, you see it around advanced manufacturing in the East Midlands. And I think the other thing that really comes through here is, again, it's not just about kind of a tariff regime. It's about investment. It's about investment in those exporters and then in those systems that support them. So, okay. You know, we, for example, are the biggest private investor in transport infrastructure outside the M25 in the country. And our investments into big airports are really, really important to allow that growth and that those new connections to develop.
I can't let you go without asking about the budget. It's next week now. It's getting closer and closer. What are Manchester Airports Group hoping for, looking for in that budget?
Yes, well, what we're looking for in the budget is stability and predictability and kind of common sense viability to allow us to focus on that very long-term investment. Our business cases are decades long, and really to become that route to growth that the government is looking for. One of the big things we're thinking about with this budget is business rates. We're a big company, we're growing well, so we pay quite a lot of taxes. One of the biggest bills, and that is business rates, and that's fair enough. We'd expect that to go up. But there are some accounts out there, you've seen them in the media, talking of 300, 400% increases, and that would be huge for us. I mean, it would mean business rates could become certainly bigger than post-tax profit, but bigger than our wage bill. So the industry has been talking to ministers and officials for a number of months, and we're hopeful that we'll see a good resolution of that in the short term and a long-term framework that allows stability for that, for the kind of investments we've been talking about.
Andrew McMillan, Chief Strategy Officer at Manchester Airports Group, thank you very much indeed. Well, we heard those reports on Friday that the Chancellor had decided against increasing income tax in the budget next week. But following those reports, government borrowing costs jumped. And over the course of Friday, the interest rate, interest rates on 10-year government bonds climbed from 4.44% to 4.57%. Let's talk to Emma Wall, who's Chief Investment Strategist at Hargreaves Lansdown. Emma, presumably investors will be watching the bond markets very closely when they open later this morning.
Yeah, very much so. And not just the bond markets. As you said there, we had a record jump in bond yields, the biggest jump since April. But actually, all UK assets suffered on Friday on the rumours. We should say it's still rumours. Nothing's been confirmed. But the markets very much had baked in, it seems, this idea that income taxes would rise in the UK. And when that news broke early Friday morning, we saw the pound fall, you saw the FTSE 100 fall, and indeed the bond market fall, which resulted in yields moving higher. It's quite unusual to have the combination of all three. Normally, actually, when the pound falls, that's a positive thing for the FTSE 100 because 75% of its revenues are from overseas and therefore not sterling, but actually really shows how much actually the potential that the Chancellor is not giving herself enough fiscal headroom, that negative sentiment really weighed on UK assets. And so we'll be looking at the open today to see if some of those losses are pared back a bit.
Now, we know that Jaguar Land Rover, the cyber attack there, hit economic growth as a whole in September. But we've also heard from JLR how hard they were hit specifically financially. The carmaker posted a £485 million loss for the 3 months to the end of September. And that compares with a profit of £398 million for the same period last year. Now, this is a private company, so there's no share price to watch. But investors know that this is a central business in an important industry. They'll be looking for ripple effects.
Yeah, so it is part of a listed business, which is listed in India, Tata Motors, which actually has opened this morning down 6%. It's come up a bit since then, but it's still down 4.5% in Indian trading today. But as you say, this has been a significant impact, not just on the company itself. So the cyber attack alone cost £200 million, and it's estimated to have cost the British economy nearly £2 billion. And we saw that in the GDP figures that were announced last week. I have to say, I think this is one of those stories that will continue to have ramifications, because one of the reasons it's had such a wide-ranging impact is it's not just the business itself, but all of the supply chain that is dependent on that business. And while things are back up and running, I think we'll continue to see figures coming out from the broader motor industry and the supply chain of the motor industry and how that's been affected in coming months.
Emma Wall from Hargreaves Lansdown, thank you very much indeed. Now, lawyers for Google and the US Department of Justice will begin closing arguments this week in a case that could have major implications for the tech giant's advertising business. And that business makes up more than three quarters of its revenue. So back in April, a judge in the US state of Virginia ruled that Google has an illegal monopoly in online advertising technology, which determines which adverts are placed online and where. Bill Kovacic is Global Competition Professor of Law and Policy at George Washington University and a former commissioner of the US competition regulator, the Federal Trade Commission, joins us now. Bill, good morning. This actually comes after a similar case which saw a judge rule that Google had to share data with its rivals to help open up competition in online search. What are the two sides arguing in this case, though?
In this case, the Department of Justice is arguing that the entire proceeding involving ad tech has been fruitless unless the judge orders a divestiture, specifically of Google's ad exchange operations, that the entire effort to discipline Google would have gone awry unless that divestiture is ordered. Google is saying that is disproportionate to the harm that was found, and that the divestiture order would be highly destructive to the beneficial operation of its enterprise.
Now, when the judge ruled in April, Google responded by saying publishers have many options and they choose Google because our ad tech tools are simple, affordable and effective. What do you make of that?
The judge found quite clearly that that's not the case, that in many respects, the behavior that you observe with both publishers and advertisers is a consequence of Google's successful effort to bundle together its publisher and advertising side of its ad tech to compel people to use Google's products to the exclusion of other possibilities that firms could turn to otherwise. So she has made fairly clear rulings that it is not simply the fact of Google providing a superior product. It's the fact of the way in which they operate the business and compel firms to use them and them alone.
What kind of outcome then do you think we could get in this case? What could the judge say Google has to do?
The judge could very well decide, and she has hinted at this somewhat, that a very clear and strong injunction that prohibited the continuation of the illegal practices, that compelled some degree of interoperability, that forbade discrimination of the kind and tying and bundling that she condemned earlier, might be sufficient. There are a number of places in which she expressed skepticism about the ease and feasibility of carrying out a divestiture remedy. And the modern Supreme Court jurisprudence tends to encourage judges to be very cautious about imposing more dramatic remedies. So my intuition is that she is more likely in this instance to seek a behavioral remedy rather than compel a divestiture.
Bill Kovacic, former commissioner of the U.S. competition regulator, the Federal Trade Commission. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phyllis. 29 minutes past six. Let's take a look at the sport. Mike's here. Morning.
Morning, and a very busy day yesterday. Loads to cram in this morning. So where to start? Well, how about football? And you have to say, that is how you qualify for a World Cup. 8 games, 8 wins, 22 goals scored, 0 conceded.
Rashford onto his right foot. Kills it. Kane with a chance. Heads it in. It's 2 for England and 2 for Harry Kane.
Yeah, what a great way to finish, you know, to win 8 out of 8, to score, I think, 22 goals, concede 0. And from my point of view, I just have to keep doing what I'm doing. You know, it's a long way from now until the World Cup, but I take as much care as I can of my body and avoid any injuries and then just go full throttle into next summer.
Yes, wrap that man, Harry Kane, in cotton wool will be the cry from many England fans after he scored the 77th and 78th goals for his country in England's 2-0 win away to Albania yesterday to complete the perfect qualifying campaign. Story of the day yesterday, though, was surely the Republic of Ireland's late, late show in Budapest.
Last few seconds here, Ireland looking for the winning goal, the knockdown by Ron. Oh, it is! They've done it! Remarkable! What a moment! Can you believe it? Ireland have got the winning goal in stoppage time. Troy Parrott, you wonder. Wow!
I can't believe what I'm saying. We're dreaming. Absolutely dreaming.
Yes, Ireland scored in the 96th minute to beat Hungary 3-2 and sneak into the World Cup playoffs by the skin of their teeth. We will have more on this story in the next hour of the programme. Next to rugby union, and what was going on at Murrayfield yesterday?
And this is madness. Missed tackle on the outside, and Argentina are going to score in the corner, and that'll be the game, surely. Argentina have stunned Murrayfield.
It wasn't good enough. We know Argentina are a quality side, and to build that lead required a lot of effort and skill, but we needed to see it home. We're on the back foot for too long.
Gregor Townsend's Scotland were 21-0 up against Argentina, but blew it in the second half to lose 33-24 and make it back-to-back defeats in the autumn internationals. Better news for Rory McIlroy this weekend, who's celebrating winning a 7th Race to Dubai title, leaving the Masters champion to reflect on what has surely been the best year of his career.
I'll have a nice time over the Christmas period and New Year period to really reflect on everything. You know, I've reflected a lot on the Masters, obviously, but I think this end of season, the Irish Open or the Ryder Cup, meant to reflect on this as well alongside them at the end of the year and have a toast with a few people to an amazing year. I'm looking forward to that.
McIlroy finished runner-up to Ryder Cup teammate Matt Fitzpatrick at the DP World Tour Championship in Dubai. In darts, world champion Luke Littler is now the world number one for the very first time after winning the Grand Slam of darts yesterday. Christmas and Ali Pali just round the corner, of course. And finally, to tennis's ATP finals, where for the second year in a row, the winner was Sinner.
It is back-to-back titles for Sinner in Turin.
There is no better ending for me and the season. It was a very, very tough and close matchup, but I'm extremely happy how I handled the situation, and it means the world to me.
Yes, Jannik Sinner beat the world number one, Carlos Alcaraz, in the ATP final yesterday in straight sets.
Great performance. Thank you, Mike.
Snuggle up by an old stone fireplace and enjoy a cup of cocoa.
Christmas films on BBC iPlayer.
Here we are on the run-up to Christmas.
Christmas. Excellent. Great. Big whoopee.
If you're not feeling festive yet...
No, not as such.
Oh. Spark your Christmas spirit.
Make this a good one
with Nativity.
Are we ready to give it a go?
The Holiday.
Okay, let's go.
Bridget Jones's Diary.
That's the one.
And more.
Sounds perfect.
Festive film favourites on BBC iPlayer.
It's that time of year already. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Nick Robinson in London at 27 minutes to 7. Here's Caroline Nicholls with the summary of the news.
The government will today set out full details of its overhaul of the asylum system, including changes to human rights laws, to make it easier to deport illegal migrants. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, wants to end multiple appeals against removal and limit how much people can argue their case based on the right to family life. She's described tackling illegal migration as a moral mission. President Trump has urged Republicans in the House of Representatives to back a bill requiring the release of all unclassified government records, documents and communications on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A vote on the Epstein Files Transparency Act is expected this week. Mr. Trump has come under pressure from within his own party to make the material public. The United States says it will designate the Venezuelan crime group Cartel de los Soles as a foreign terrorist organisation, allowing Washington to act more aggressively against the group and its alleged associates. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said President Nicolas Maduro is the organisation's leader, which he denies. A court in Bangladesh is preparing to deliver its verdict against the former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who's being tried in absentia for crimes against humanity. The case centres on a crackdown on student-led protests that toppled her government last year. The UN believes up to 1,400 people died. Sheikh Hasina, who denies all charges, fled to India, where she remains. A couple from Hertfordshire who were arrested in January after making complaints about their daughter's primary school on a WhatsApp group say police have paid them £20,000 in damages. Hertfordshire police said at the time the arrests were necessary to investigate allegations of harassment and malicious communications. Technology, which was originally developed for Formula One cars, is being used to try to improve Wi-Fi on trains. A 60-day pilot scheme will use a hybrid system of signals from both phone masts and satellites to create superfast connections on board.
Thank you, Caroline. As you were hearing there, more announcements from the Home Secretary this morning on how the government is planning to tackle illegal migration. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, is with us. Morning, Henry.
Good morning.
So what are we going to hear from Shabana Mahmood today?
Well, this is a really extensive package, which Shabana Mahmood will be outlining in the House of Commons later. She says these are the most significant reforms to the asylum system in decades. The new elements that we're hearing about for the first time today is that Shabana Mahmood is confirming new legislation to change how Article 8, that's the right to family life in the European Convention on Human Rights, is applied in court cases here in the UK. She's also talking about plans to change the law so that those refused asylum can't make multiple appeals. And she's also threatening three specific countries, Angola, Namibia and the Democratic Republic of Congo, with visa restrictions if they don't accept the return of their criminals and illegal immigrants. That goes with what we heard at the weekend, which is about refugee status becoming more of a temporary status and also wanting everyone's refugee status to be reviewed every 30 months to see if their country has become safe. The argument that she'll make in the House of Commons later is that all of those measures create the political space for this government to create new capped, safe and legal routes for refugees who are genuinely fleeing persecution. I think that ultimate end goal is designed to assuage some Labour MPs who are a bit anxious about this.
Yeah, how is this all going down in the party, Henry?
Yeah, I think there is some anxiety. I think there are those who embrace it for sure. But I think there is unease, actually, not just on the left of the Labour Party, where you might expect it. Also, an interesting post on X last night from Tony Vaughan, the MP for Folkestone on the Kent coast. He said the Prime Minister said in September that we are at a fork in the road. These asylum proposals suggest we have taken the wrong turning. I think you also shouldn't assume that all of the unease comes just from the left or even from the middle of the Labour Party. I've spoken to some on the right of the Labour Party who are a bit unsure about this. There is a sort of, it might sound niche, but I think interesting and important division on the right of the Labour Party between those who would see themselves as progressives and those who would align themselves more with the so-called Blue Labour movement. I think that might come more to the fore. The argument that Shabana Mahmood privately and people around her are making to Labour MPs is that they have to do this. One person around Shabana Mahmood said to me last night, if we don't do this, then what will come after us will be darker, a lot darker.
Thank you, Henry. We will continue to explore those announcements on the programme, both politically and legally as well. So much more to come on that particular story before nine.
23 minutes to seven now. In the last few hours, Donald Trump has executed a pretty spectacular U-turn, having spent weeks attacking those on his own side demanding the release of the Epstein files. He's now posted on Truth Social that he does, after all, want Republicans in the House of Representatives to vote to release those files. We will be hearing from one of them in the next hour. First, though, the background to this story from our senior North American correspondent, Anthony Zerker.
It's a pretty dramatic turnaround. And I think, you know, part of it you have to look at. Donald Trump has always had his finger on the pulse of his base. And for weeks, if not months now, he has been out of step with the base of his party, with his grassroots, with the Make America Great Again loyalists. And this is him trying to get back ahead of the pack, because it's very clear, abundantly clear now, that this measure was going to pass in the House of Representatives, and that it was going to be a blow to Donald Trump. And people are going to start questioning whether he has the same kind of influence now that he has in the past.
But only days ago, he was attacking the leader of the calls to publish these files, Marjorie Taylor Greene, as a traitor, wacky and a raving lunatic.
Attacking Marjorie Taylor Greene, attacking Thomas Massie, who was one of the co-sponsors of the legislation. And there was a considerable amount of pressure on Wednesday from the Trump administration and from Donald Trump himself to try to prevent these signatures from being placed on this discharge petition that was filed that would trigger this vote. He was called Lauren Boebert, a congresswoman from Colorado, into the White House to try to get her to take her name off that list in order to deny it the sufficient number of signatures to get it over the hump. And he wasn't able to do that. So, yeah, it is, you know, once that happened, the writing was on the wall. And then in the ensuing days, it became increasingly clear that there were dozens, maybe even more than 100 Republicans who were going to back this when it came to a vote. And for Donald Trump to explicitly call for his party to do something and then have 100 members in the House of Representatives go against him, I think that would have been a very grievous blow to his influence in this town.
So the House will vote to release the Epstein files. Have we any idea how soon they will be released?
Well, there's another step that has to happen before, actually two steps that have to happen before the files are released. The Senate will have to vote on it, and then Donald Trump himself would have to sign it into law. And you'll note when Donald Trump took to Truth Social to say he now encourages all the members of the House of Representatives, all the Republicans, to support this, he didn't say anything about a vote in the Senate or calling on Republican legislators in that chamber to do it. And the Senate is a complicated chamber where it is easy for things to get buried. And in theory, this could disappear there, perhaps even without coming to a vote. So as much as this is a remarkable change of course by Donald Trump in the House of Representatives, the next thing we'll need to watch is whether he uses that same influence to push for a vote in the Senate or not.
Anthony Zurcher in Washington, thank you.
My pleasure.
19 minutes to 7 now. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in France today for the latest round of talks on international military support for the country in its war against Russia. Andrew Harding is our correspondent in Paris covering the talks. Andrew, what will President Zelensky be hoping will be on the agenda today?
Good morning, Anna. Well, he's talking about, quote, an historic agreement with France about strengthening Ukraine's fighting force, air defence in particular, defence capabilities more generally. And I think that is going to be the main focus. What can France provide? There's talk here of a Patriot-style air defence systems, more fighter jets or equipment for fighter jets to support Ukraine's capacity to defend itself from these extraordinary, relentless Russian air bombardments. You may remember the last time Zelensky was here in Paris, and this is his ninth visit, but in September, the focus was on the Coalition of the Willing, this force that Keir Starmer was really leading on to try and create some sort of momentum for a reassurance force after a ceasefire with Russia. But I think very few people these days have any optimism about Putin agreeing to a ceasefire. So really the focus now, less on diplomacy, less on those kind of post-ceasefire agreements, and really just relentless focus on what can Europe do faster and better, both to learn from Ukraine about what works on the battlefield and to help it to arm itself much more quickly and much more robustly.
And just a brief thought, Andrew, President Zelensky is facing a corruption scandal at home. Is that likely to have any impact on his allies' decisions to invest?
Look, it's come up in the briefing notes here in Paris, and obviously it's going to be something that will be mentioned in negotiations. I think the particular focus is going to be on, look, Ukraine, if you want to continue with accession talks for the European Union, for membership of the EU, you need to sort this out. And it is a glass half full, half empty situation, because, yes, it's a concern about these these corruption scandals that are still going on in Ukraine, but at least they are tackling them. There are encouraging signs of arrests and so on.
Andrew Harding, thank you.
It is now 17 minutes to seven. One of the key agreements protecting the Amazonian rainforest is under threat from powerful Brazilian agribusiness interests. The pact bans the sale of soybeans, Brazil's largest agricultural export, grown on Amazon land deforested after 2008. Soya is an important ingredient in many animal feeds. Around 10% of the soy imported in the UK comes from the Amazon. The ban, known as the soy moratorium, is credited with having prevented huge areas of the Amazon from being destroyed. Justin Rowland now reports.
So we've come out into the river and we can see this vast port complex. There are three huge silos where they store the beans. And then a giant, everything is huge here, a giant sort of conveyor belt that goes out on a huge bridge to the deeper water where there's a docking complex, and there's a cargo ship in there now. We can see it being filled with soy, dust rising up from its great hold. And there was outrage when this port was built a couple of decades ago, which helped create the pressure for the soya moratorium, which was a landmark agreement where farmers, environmental groups and international food companies, including some of the biggest players, companies like McDonald's, agreed not to buy soya from newly deforested Amazon land. Soya is a key ingredient in animal and fish feeds, and global demand is rising. Around 10% of UK soya comes from here in the Amazon. But now members of Brazil's powerful agricultural lobby, backed by some politicians, are pushing to scrap the arrangement. Vanderlei Ataides is president of the Soy Farmers Association of Pará State, one of the main soy-growing areas.
Our state has a lot of room to grow, and the soy moratorium is working against this development. How does this help the environment? I can't plant soybeans, but I can use the same land to plant corn, rice, cotton, other crops. Why can't we plant soybeans?
Environmental campaigners are horrified. Bell Lyon is chief advisor on Latin America at the World Wildlife Fund, one of the original signatories to the soy moratorium.
If the Amazon soy moratorium comes to an end, it would be a disaster for the Amazon, for its people and for the world, because it could open up an area of the size of Portugal for deforestation.
Small-scale farmers say the soy plantations literally change the weather. Raimundo Barbosa and his family use rudimentary machines to process starchy tapioca roots into a roasted flour, a staple food in Brazil.
The large soy farms destroy the environment, leaving everything devastated. Where there's forests, it's normal, but where there isn't, it gets hotter and hotter and there is less rain. The big farmer plant sells it to a trading company and it feeds the animals in Europe. And here, there are no jobs.
We're climbing to the top of a 45-metre tower in a rainforest reserve. It's bristling with high-tech sensors, which have been measuring evaporation, CO2 levels, solar radiation and much more for more than 27 years. It is part of a huge scientific project, the Large-Scale Biosphere-Atmosphere Experiment, and it confirms the farmers' instincts.
The living forest is closing down and not producing rainfall anymore, not producing water vapour.
The project is run by scientist Bruce Fosberg. He fears that as the forest dries, it could be pushing rainforest in this region towards a tipping point.
We're already starting to see some of the taller trees dying and losing their capacity to maintain themselves. Suggests that we're already starting a process of savannization here.
He means the rainforest ecosystem is giving way to dry grassland.
So
So we've come out into one of these vast, vast soil fields. But in the middle of the field is a single tall tree that they've left standing. And it's a castanheira tree, they'd call it in Portuguese. In English, we'd call it a Brazil tree, a Brazil nut tree. They keep these trees standing because they are symbols of this country, symbols of Brazil. But standing here looking at it, it is also an incredibly powerful symbol of just how much deforestation pressure the Amazon rainforest is still under.
As Justin Rolat reporting, our climate editor, it's 12 minutes to 7 now. BBC Eye has uncovered new evidence about the Haditha massacre during the Iraq War in 2005. Now, this led to the longest and most expensive war crimes investigation in US military history. But no one has ever served time in jail for the killings of 24 people, many of them women and children. Lara El-Jabali has worked on this story for BBC Eye. Lara, it was a shocking event during the Iraq War, but as we were saying there, the people involved in it have never really seen any kind of justice.
Yes, we've been following the story for the past 4 years, and we've been in touch with the families in Iraq, and we've gone to visit them many times, and they haven't actually been informed what happened as a result of the case that was happening in the United States. I mean, they now know that nobody was held to justice, but they've never understood why. And that's kind of always remained a mystery. It was the longest war crimes investigation in the US. The investigation took over 6 years. In the end, only the squad leader was actually put to trial, and he ended up taking a plea deal and not serving any time in prison. So for the families in Iraq, they feel that they've never really had any answers as to why no one was held accountable for their families' deaths.
So what has your investigation shown, Lara, and how has that been received by those who worked on the case?
Our investigation has shown that several Marines who were never brought to trial, in fact, one of them was given immunity and never charged with anything at all in relation to the deaths, that two of these Marines seem to very, very likely be involved in the death of one Iraqi family. This was one of the most notorious killings that day. An entire family, including five children, were killed in the back bedroom of a house. And we've been in touch with the one survivor from that family, Safa Yunus, who has always been searching for answers about what happened to her siblings, her mother, her aunt, and her father. And our investigation shows that one of the Marines who claims that he never entered the back bedroom, because the Marines' testimonies all contradicted with one another, and that was what was so difficult about this case. Our investigation shows that he actually did go into that room that he claimed never to have entered, where the women and children were killed, and that his testimony likely indicates, along with the others, that he was one of the possible killers.
I went inside the room. I tried to take a better look at what's going on.
You walked about how many feet into the room?
I walked about 8 feet.
So that is a clip, an audio recording from the trial where this Marine, Umberto Mendoza, says he actually did walk into the room. And we played that clip for forensic analyst Mike Maloney. He was sent to Haditha to investigate the case 20 years ago, and he worked for the NCIS, and he thought that this clip was hugely significant.
So this is just amazing to me. Now he's going 8 feet into the room, which is the shooter position. What I'd say is Mendoza confessed to everything except for pulling the trigger.
And why, Lara, were none of them prosecuted, and did some of them receive immunity?
Many of them did receive immunity. When we spoke to the forensic expert, he said that he was going to take the stand and testify and say that it was these two Marines, Mendoza and Tatum, who committed the killings in the back bedroom. But a plea deal was reached before he could actually take the stand. And we've spoken to several of the lawyers who were involved in the case, lawyers for the Marines, who believe that the outcome of the case was a misprosecution and a miscarriage of justice.
Lara El-Jabali, thank you. There's a lot of ways to find out more about this story. You might remember, actually, when I was on Today about 10 days ago and I was in Iraq, I was working on BBC Global Eye, which you can see tonight, BBC Two, 7 o'clock, which contains that investigation. And you can see the full Eye documentary as well, No Justice, Just Kills. It's on BBC iPlayer and on the BBC World Service YouTube channel as well.
Look forward to that. 8 minutes to 7.
you will not have failed to notice, the weather was terrible over the weekend, and people, particularly in Monmouth in Wales, are clearing up after suffering significant flooding. There were homes and shops underwater. There are questions being asked about whether the level of preparation was good enough, given that heavy rain was forecast. Jeremy Parr is head of Flood and Incident Risk Management for Natural Resources Wales. Good morning.
Good morning.
Were there sufficient flood warnings put out?
There were sufficient flood warnings put out. We had the weather information from the Met Office in advance of these events. You have to say anybody who's been flooded, it is absolutely devastating, and thoughts and sympathies go out to everybody. But in terms of the forecast, there was an amber weather warning. We were active in working with local authorities and partner organisations to get ready for any flooding. But it is extremely difficult to pinpoint exactly where the worst impacts are going to be. We saw record levels on this river, once again, record levels being set, and it's happening more and more often in more and more locations.
Do you think, Jeremy, we need to look again at those flood warnings? Because as you say, they're being given, but especially at this time of year, they happen a lot, and perhaps people aren't taking them as seriously as they need to.
It's really important that people do take them seriously, but also the weather warnings as well in the lead up to events. As we get closer, we are able to look at where the worst of the impacts are going to be. So in the lead up to this, we were active in the media saying that Monmouthshire looks like there is going to be severe weather. The flood warnings did go out on the Friday, and then unfortunately four severe flood warnings on that river in the Monmouthshire area. I think the thing with Monmouth to also recognise is that it does have flood defences, and unfortunately those flood defences were overtopped with the really exceptional levels of water that were coming down that river. So we do have to look at this problem very, very hard. There's no one single solution to it. Unfortunately, flood defences play a role, but they can be overtopped, they can be exceeded with these extreme events. We need to be looking at whole system approaches here.
Lots of different elements, aren't there? Jeremy Parr, thank you for joining us.
It is now 6 minutes, 5 minutes it is actually, to seven. The way human rights laws are used to stop the deportation of failed asylum seekers is to be reformed by the government as part of a tougher package of measures meant to cut the numbers crossing the channel in small boats. What do the Conservatives actually oppose? Let's ask Matt Vickers, who is the Shadow Minister of State responsible for this. Morning to you, Mr. Vickers.
Good morning.
Are you prepared to welcome these policies, even if, as I'm sure you'll say, you don't think they go far enough?
Well, we welcome anything if the government pulls its finger out and gets on with trying to tackle this issue. It is a huge challenge for this country. It comes at a huge cost to taxpayers. It's blatantly unfair. So we welcome any positive moves by the government. But the reality is this is small steps, some small steps in the right direction, but largely gimmicks. And we know this government, when it tackles immigration, its approach to immigration is governed by gimmicks. We've seen the one-in, one-out scheme. Yes. 16,000 people have arrived in the country since
it started. Well, let's talk about what they're
99.5% of them have got to stay. They're going to smash the gangs.
Time is short, Mr. Vickers. So let's talk about what they're proposing, what you think about it. Are they right to try and restrict the use of what was called Article 8? Conservative ministers said it for a very long time. It's the thing that gives people a right to family life. You back them on that, do you?
Well, the reality is we're not going far enough. The government is not going far enough. The only way to solve this crisis is that people, when they get in those boats, know they will not be able to stay. They'll stop paying those people smuggling gangs. People need to know that when they arrive in this country, they will be removed. And what we've seen in recent months is increasing numbers of cases falling short in the courts and the system failing to operate.
So do you back the change to Article 8?
The reality is 55% more people are arriving in this country since the general election.
Do you back the change to Article 8, Mr. Vickers?
We need to leave the ECHR. Successive governments have tried to tamper and amend Article 8. It isn't a thing. It will not work. You need to leave the ECHR. You need to put this elected government, this parliament, in charge of deciding who does and doesn't arrive in the country.
You've got to have somewhere to send people, haven't you, Mr. Vickers? It's not just that you need, in your view, to get rid of the legal barriers to people being deported. You have to have countries that are willing to receive them. Now, the government is saying today that it will refuse to give visas for legal migration from countries that don't cooperate in taking back people who are here illegally. Do you welcome that?
We support the use of visa sanctions to ensure that people go home. We know that the only way to get the numbers down is to remove people. The reality is it was already in legislation. The last government put that into force so that you can remove...
Why did you have such a crisis then?
We put it into force. We gave the opportunity to remove people using visa sanctions. It needed to be used more greatly.
Yeah, but Mr. Vickers, I don't want to be boring about this, but you were in office for 14 years and you won four elections. So presumably it's not quite as easy as you're suggesting it is it?
We have said if we leave the ECHR, if we start removing people within a week of them arriving, people will stop coming. That is what we need to do. That is the way forward. The problem is...
Where do they go to, Mr. Vickers?
The problem was too high.
Where do they go to?
Home. Home.
What, even to countries that refuse to take them?
Well, that's why we put in place the Rwanda scheme, an opportunity to send people to a safe third country. People need to know wherever they come from, they will not be able to stay in this country.
How many went to Rwanda?
If they enter illegally, they will not be allowed to stay. There was a very limited number of people went to Rwanda because the scheme was about to start. Okay. The first thing that Keir Starmer did when he arrived in office was to remove that scheme, bring an end to the idea that we remove people. And we knew it worked because when we put in place a scheme with Albania, which was the top place from which people were arriving, the number arriving fell by 93%.
Matt Vickers, we're going to leave it there because we're going to the news, I'm afraid, and the weather. But thank you very much for your time. Matt Vickers there, the Shadow Home Office Minister.
King has the weather.
Anna, thanks so much indeed. Yeah, it's turning pretty cold actually for many parts of the UK, starting off this morning on a cold and for some a bit of a frosty start, especially northwest England and southwest Scotland. But down the eastern side of the UK, we've got some showers moving in today. Some of those turning a little bit wintry over the higher ground of northeast Scotland, over the North York Moors as well. Down at low levels, it is mostly of rain. Some of those showers could move their way a bit further inland with a rather brisk north-northwesterly wind, but actually for most parts of England and Wales, it's going to be dry. There'll be lots of sunshine through today, and maximum temperatures across England and Wales getting to about 5 to 10 degrees. For Western Scotland and Northern Ireland, here we've got some sunshine again, but the cloud will tend to increase a little bit during the afternoon. Later, by this evening, we'll see some rain moving its way through Northern Ireland into Western Scotland. That will turn to snow over the higher ground of Western Scotland through this evening and tonight, and maximum temperatures getting to about 3 to 8 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 17th of November. The headlines this morning: the Home Secretary wants to change human rights laws as part of what she's called the biggest overhaul of the asylum system in a generation. We've heard from the Conservatives dismissing the plans. We'll hear from a former Supreme Court justice after the news. President Trump has performed a U-turn on the Epstein files and urged Republicans in Congress to vote to release the documents. We speak to a member of the committee responsible at 7:30.
He realized that the press was solely going to focus on this until everything was released, and so that's what he's doing.
And a couple who were arrested after complaining about their daughter's school in a parents' WhatsApp group say they've been paid damages by the police. We hear from them soon after the news.
I'm angry mostly for my children. I'm angry that this had to happen in front of my three-year-old daughter, who was cowering in the corner, scared, watched her parents be carted away by the police when there was no need for it.
Also in the next hour of the programme, the UN's aid chief speaks to us from the heart of Sudan's brutal civil war and why Sky Sports launched and then scrapped a new TikTok channel for female sports fans.
From the stands to the group chats, the merch drops to the meetups, girls aren't just watching anymore. We run the fandom now.
No, not bad, huh? Because following
sports... Before that, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
Human rights laws are to be changed as part of the government's overhaul of the asylum system, with new measures introduced to make it easier to deport illegal migrants. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, will set out a raft of new policies in the House of Commons this afternoon. She said that tackling illegal migration is a moral mission, but the plans are likely to meet with opposition from within Labour. Our political correspondent, Joe Pike, reports.
The latest announcement in Shabana Mahmood's sweeping overhaul of the immigration system is new legislation to change how Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights is applied in migration court cases. It protects the right to family life, but the government wants it to apply only to close families such as parents or children, and wants judges to give more weight to the wider public interest. Ministers hope the reforms will make deportations easier. The Home Secretary also plans to change the law so those refused asylum can't make multiple appeals, and she is threatening Angola, Namibia and the Democratic Republic of the Congo with visa restrictions if they don't accept the return of their criminals and illegal immigrants. The government is billing these proposals as the most significant reforms to the asylum system in decades. But there is already some scepticism in government and on Labour's backbenches. One MP has told the BBC these plans are a step too far. Another said they had big reservations. Both the Conservatives and Reform UK have expressed doubts as to whether the plans will ever get through the Commons.
President Trump has called on Republicans in the lower house of Congress to release government files on the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein in a change from his previous position. Mr. Trump has come under pressure from within his own Republican Party to release the files, something he said he would do when he was campaigning for the White House. The president has been posting on social media, as Tom Simons reports.
Donald Trump said, "We have nothing to hide," and Republicans in the House of Representatives should vote to release the files. The House Oversight Committee is investigating the US federal government's handling of the Epstein case. Mr. Trump said, "It should have whatever it's legally entitled to. I don't care," he posted in capitals. It's a reversal of position as, slowly but surely, the political tide turns in favour of full disclosure of the files. The Democrats on the Oversight Committee published selected emails mentioning Donald Trump last week. The House is preparing to vote on a bill which would result in everything being released. Yesterday, a co-sponsor of the bill said 100 members of the president's own party could now back it.
The United States says it will declare a Venezuelan criminal group, which it claims includes the president, Nicolas Maduro, as a foreign terrorist organisation. There's been growing speculation of a possible US military attack on Venezuela. American defence officials say they've deployed the world's biggest aircraft carrier to the Caribbean Sea to tackle drug trafficking. 80 people have been killed in weeks of strikes against what the US has described as narco-terrorists in the region. Here's our South America correspondent, Ione Wells.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the US would designate the Cartel de los Soles as a foreign terrorist organization. Washington claims it is a criminal group involved in drug trafficking and led by the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro, which he strongly denies. The US hasn't published evidence publicly of his direct involvement in trafficking, but its characterization of Mr. Maduro is seen as a way for the US to possibly justify targeting him or those close to him as part of its military campaign against drug trafficking. Last night, Donald Trump said he thought Venezuela would like to have talks with the United States. In a blow to the US, though, people in Ecuador voted against allowing foreign military bases in the country again, something the US had been hoping would bolster its operations in the Eastern Pacific.
A court in Bangladesh is delivering a verdict against the deposed Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who's being tried in absentia for crimes against humanity. She denies the charges, which relate to a crackdown on the student-led protests which toppled her government last year. Hundreds are believed by the UN to have been killed. Sheikh Hasina fled to India, where she remains. Security forces have been deployed across the country for the verdict. The UN humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher, says his teams need urgent access to the devastated Sudanese city of Al-Fasher to help civilians still stranded there. Mr. Fletcher is on a visit to the Darfur region, which he described as the current epicentre of global inhumanity. In an interview for this programme, he said he was having tough conversations with the paramilitary rapid support forces now controlling the city about getting in aid and investigators. Mr. Fletcher said he'd heard harrowing testimony of what had happened in Al-Fasher.
I'm meeting survivors of mass executions, survivors of mass rapes. A woman I met 2 days ago in Tawila, she'd seen her husband murdered in front of her. She'd escaped. Her neighbour had been murdered. She'd managed to scoop up the young, malnourished child of her neighbour and carry the child all the way to Tawila from Al-Fasher.
Authorities in eastern Ukraine say 3 people have been killed in Russian missile strikes in the Kharkiv region. Russian state media says its air defences destroyed 36 Ukrainian drones overnight. President Zelensky is in France for talks with President Macron about European military support for Kyiv and the state of negotiations about a ceasefire with Russia. A couple from Hertfordshire who were arrested in January after making complaints about their daughter's primary school on a WhatsApp group say police have paid them damages. Maxie Allen and Rosalind Levine say they were held on suspicion of harassment and malicious communications. Hertfordshire police have been approached for comment. Duncan Kennedy reports.
Maxie Allen and his partner Rosalind Levine from Boreham Wood told The Times six officers came to arrest them and that they were held for 11 hours. According to the paper, the dispute had arisen after the couple had been banned from entering the Cowley Hill Primary School as they questioned the recruitment process for a head teacher and criticised the school's leadership in a parents' WhatsApp group. The school then contacted the police after receiving a high volume of messages and social media posts sent by the couple. The couple admitted emailing the school regularly, but said it was to discuss their daughter's special needs. Ms. Levine told the BBC that the police had now admitted liability for unlawful arrest and paid them £20,000 in damages.
Police say organised gangs are using increasingly advanced methods to steal cargo from lorries across the UK. A BBC investigation has found that in some cases, criminals are buying legitimate haulage companies, collecting loads for delivery and then disappearing with the goods. Deputy Chief Constable Jane Meir is the freight crime lead at the National Police Chiefs Council.
What we do know is it's becoming more sophisticated, more organised, and in policing we need to work with industry to equal that and make sure that we are focused and proactive in our response.
The problem of poor Wi-Fi on trains could potentially be solved thanks to technology originally developed for Formula One cars. A pilot scheme will use a hybrid system of signals from both phone masts and satellites to create superfast connections on board. Our business correspondent Mark Ashton has more details.
With average download speeds of around a megabit per second, one study ranked the UK as one of the worst major European and Asian nations for train Wi-Fi. A 60-day pilot scheme aims to change that. An intercity express train on Great Western Railway, which runs from London Paddington to Penzance, will use a hybrid of mobile phone masts on the ground with low Earth orbit satellites to create a more reliable connection. The technology was first developed for Formula One cars, and the company behind it said switching between the ground and space-based networks would reduce dropouts in signal.
Mark Ashdown reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 9 minutes past seven. The Home Secretary is to tell Parliament this afternoon how the government plans to tackle illegal migration. And after a blitz of proposals for changing the system over the weekend, today's is that UK human rights law will be looked at again to make the deportation of people who've come to this country illegally easier. This is Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And what Shabana Mahmood wants to do is narrow the definition of the right to family life, meaning that only very close relatives like parents or children would be able to use it in court as a reason to stay in the UK. Now, I've been looking at the political ramifications of this morning, but let's look at it through a legal lens with Lord Sumption, former Supreme Court judge. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have had your concerns about the ECHR, and I want to explore those in just a moment. But before we do, what do you make of what is going to be announced today and what has been announced over the weekend? Do you think it is a way to solve some of the issues at hand?
Well, it will certainly have some effect, though I suspect not a very great effect. The idea, as I understand it, is to direct UK judges as to how they are to interpret the European Convention. Now, if we pass an act in the UK that tells judges to interpret the Convention in a particular way, and the Strasbourg Court says it should be interpreted in a different way, then the Strasbourg Court will hold us to have violated the Convention. We will then have a direct conflict between our international obligations under the Convention and our domestic legislation. I mean, this doesn't mean that the idea is impractical, far from it. What it means is that if the government wants to stay in the convention system, and it does, then it has only very limited freedom of action. It has to draft its legislation in a way that will be acceptable to the Strasbourg Court. And that's quite difficult to do, because the Strasbourg Court is an unpredictable court, which tends to make up the legal principles as it goes along.
So you're saying difficult, but not necessarily completely impossible?
No, not at all. It very much depends on the precise details of the legislation, and we don't yet know those. All I'm saying is that it's actually a difficult and delicate business to try and work out what the Strasbourg Court will accept and what it won't.
And one of the issues that you have identified over the years is the way that the ECHR has been changed by case law, essentially, to move it quite a long way away from the original principles that were agreed.
Yes. There's nothing wrong with the rights created by the convention, but its scope has been enormously expanded. Fresh rights have been created, old rights have been expanded in a way that have no warrant in the original convention, although the convention is actually the only thing that the governments party to it have ever agreed. I regard that as contrary to the rule of law, and I regard it as inconsistent with basic principles of democratic accountability. But my concern about it is much wider than immigration. I think it's a pity, in a way, that the whole issue has been hijacked by immigration. This is a fundamental constitutional problem about how we make law for a democracy.
What can be done to try and save the ECHR, do you think? Because those founding principles are still strongly believed in by many countries. But as you say, if we get to the point where it becomes increasingly unwieldy, then more and more countries will talk about leaving, and then you risk losing something quite precious.
I think that, well, I very much doubt whether the ECHR is precious. The rights themselves are, but there are other ways in which we can give effect to those under domestic UK law. I think we've got to realise that you can protect human rights very effectively without being party to the ECHR. Countries like Canada and New Zealand, which derive their basic legal principles from the UK, have done it very successfully.
So what do you think would be the best way to progress?
I think the best way to progress would be to withdraw from the convention, to reenact its terms in purely domestic legislation construed exclusively by the UK courts. We would then be able to legislate to modify or abrogate rules emerging from the courts if we regarded them as unsuitable for our conditions or not in the public interest or for which there isn't a democratic mandate.
Lord Sumption, former Supreme Court judge, thank you for joining us. We'll get the thoughts of Alex Norris, the Minister of State for Border Security and Asylum at 10 past 8.
It's 14 minutes past 7 now. Maxie Allen and Rosalind Levine were arrested in front of their young children when six officers arrived at their house in a police van and two police cars. They were fingerprinted, searched, left in a police cell for 8 hours. Their alleged crime? Harassment, malicious communications and causing nuisance on school property. They had posted what the chair of governors of a primary school called inflammatory comments on a WhatsApp parents group. He claimed they had caused disharmony. Well, I've been speaking to Maxie and Rosalind. I asked them whether they've now felt relieved that the police had finally, after many, many weeks, acknowledged that they had, after all, been wrongfully arrested.
I mean, it was quite an emotional moment when we got the news from the police a couple of days ago. And I think overall, we were just really pleased that Hertfordshire Constabulary have recognised that this shouldn't have happened and recognised that they made quite a serious mistake. I mean, obviously, they've paid damages and they've paid costs. But for us, the main thing really was the liability that the arrest was unlawful. That's what mattered most to us, because that for us is the recognition that this is something which shouldn't have happened. And the events really put a lot of people through the ringer. I mean, apart from us, there was our 3-year-old daughter who was there when the police came to our house, our other daughter who missed her parents for the day, our neighbours who were left in tears, and our family members. So this is vindication for quite a lot of people, not just us.
Take us back to that day, if you would, Rosalind. Describe what you saw and what you remember.
I remember hearing the doorbell go, opening the door and just seeing what looked like a swarm of officers around the house. And I knew they were looking for me because one of them had asked if I was Rosalind and I said yes. But it was that initial shock and I just felt my heart drop because what could they be there for other than to deliver some terrible news? And you know, I've said previously that I thought that they were there to tell me that Sasha was dead. She has epilepsy and people can die from epilepsy. And I just felt certain that's what they were about to tell me. They wouldn't tell me immediately why they were there. They asked me to go in the house, which I went in. Then they asked me to go in the living room. It was probably no more than about 30 seconds, but those 30 seconds were, I would say, the worst of it all. Because in that moment, I knew that Sasha was dead. Thank God I was wrong. And I was relieved when I was just being arrested. But those 30 seconds were awful.
Of course, But when you were told why you were being arrested, Rosalind, were you clear what it was that you were meant to have done that was a breach of the law?
No. We know what we have and we haven't done. When they read out the list of things that I was being arrested for, malicious communications, harassment, causing a nuisance on the school premises, I knew that I hadn't done any of those things. I was pretty shocked. I knew absolutely that they wouldn't have any evidence against us. So, yeah, it was more shock, really.
Maxie, the school's chair of government had written to parents, hadn't he, warning them about what he described as inflammatory comments on social media, saying that he would not tolerate any behaviour which caused disharmony within the school. Looking back, did he have a point about that, even if this was nothing like a breach of the law?
Well, I mean, that was originally a letter to all the parents. And then when that was used in context with us, they never actually told us what it was we said that was so terrible, because they've never disclosed the WhatsApps that they got hold of. But when we look back through, the spiciest thing that we could find was Rosalind calling one senior person at the school a control freak. And that was the strongest remark we could find. And bear in mind,
so no abuse, just to be clear, no personal abuse, yeah. No swearing, no
obscene language, no threats. But also the other thing was, there's nothing that we ever wrote I wouldn't read out on your program, Nick. But the other thing was that these WhatsApps were on a private group. So it had no connection to the school. It was a private conversation between us and about a dozen other parents from our year who are on this private group that we set up. So we're not quite sure how a public authority started accessing these messages and keeping them in the first place.
We've asked multiple times, can we see these messages? Can we see these Facebook posts that led to our arrest? And we've been blocked at every opportunity. We're not allowed to see them.
How does this whole episode leave you feeling, Rosalind, about the police?
I don't trust them. They were the people that should have been there to help us. We had asked for help in the past and they hadn't been very forthcoming. They didn't want to help us. And I feel like when I see them now, I feel this horrible feeling go through me. If I see a police car drive past, if I see a policeman walk past. And I'm sad to say that I just don't trust them at all anymore.
Maxie, you're not just a parent, someone who was arrested. You are also a journalist and you're a counsellor. How should the authorities deal with people they may, and I do stress they may, regard as being a right royal pain in the you-know-where? Because that's really what this was about, wasn't it? People took against your complaints.
Yes, that kind of is what it was about. And we asked some awkward questions about the head teacher recruitment process, because I had been a governor of the school. I'd been a parent governor of the school for 4 years, and I knew the people. I used to work with the people who then called the police on us. So I knew how the school was meant to work, and I wanted things to be done properly. But to answer that question, I think, firstly, that public authorities should be very wary of getting the police involved to settle an argument. But on the other hand, legislation around these issues, around harassment and malicious communications, it's very, very old. And it is something seriously is breaking down.
Finally, Rosalind, Maxie began by talking of relief. Is there still anger?
Yes, I think there is some. And I hope in time that I can move forward from that. I'm angry mostly for my children. I'm angry that this had to happen in front of my three-year-old daughter, who was cowering in the corner, scared, watched her parents be carted away by the police when there was no need for it.
Rosalind Levine, Maxie Allen, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
A spokesperson for Hertfordshire Police says that the constabulary has accepted liability solely on the basis that the legal test around the necessity of arrest was not met in this instant. But they also add there are no issues of misconduct involving any officer in relation to this matter.
It's 21 minutes past seven now. Manufacturers say they need extra support from the government in next week's budget to deal with rising energy costs in particular. Fliss is back with more.
Yes, so the government set out plans in its industrial strategy back in June to cut costs for about 7,000 manufacturing businesses from 2027 by exempting them from things like green levies and network charges. Make UK, that's the manufacturing trade body, says it doesn't go far enough and that in her budget next week, the Chancellor should extend it to all manufacturers and bring that 2027 date forward. Well, Rowan Crozier is CEO of Brandow, which is a manufacturer of precision metal components in Birmingham. And Rowan, you're also chair of the Make UK National Advisory Board. Yours is a business that uses a lot of energy. So just explain, first of all, how your costs have been affected over the last few years.
Morning, Felicia. Yeah. Our business over the last 5 years, initially our energy costs went up from about £100,000 a year to over £500,000 a year, which was a huge increase. And we're not a very high, we're not a foundry, we're not burning furnaces, but we're a reasonably high user of energy. We've managed to control those costs down to about £250,000 a year, which is still nearly double from where we were. And we're at risk as a nation of just making our manufacturers uncompetitive if we don't do something about it.
So you want something to happen in the budget next week, but a government spokesperson said that they know energy costs are a big challenge for industry, and they said that the plan in their modern industrial strategy will cut bills. They have a point, don't they? Because the scheme as it is cuts £40 per megawatt hour from electricity bills for about 500 of those most energy intensive firms, things like steel and glassmaking. They get a 90% discount on their network charges from next year. There's also business rates relief. I mean, some people would think, well, the government is already putting a lot of support in place.
It's just the tip of the iceberg. If we just focus on the energy question, that's just, in the broadest sense, is just a few high-intensive energy users, smaller SMEs who are, as I see it, the sort of heartbeat of our nation, are not getting any of that support at all. Hence the call from Make UK to reach much further with this and give some support to every manufacturer.
So briefly, if you can, then, if more support were in place, what would it mean for a business like yours? Could you expand more, hire more, invest overseas?
I touched on it at the start. It's about being competitive. And when you look at our energy costs in comparison to other countries across the globe, we are up there in the top five of costs. If we could become more competitive in how we can procure our energy, that will allow us to win more business, which will allow us to grow, which will allow us to invest, employ more people, etc. So ultimately, it's the key to growth for me, or one of the keys.
Rowan Crozier, CEO of Brandow, thank you very much.
Thanks, Liz. It's coming up to 25 minutes past seven. Do young girls need their own sports channel? Sky thought so. So they launched a channel on TikTok to be called, and I quote, Sky Sports Little Sis. And they called it Halo.
From the stands to the group chats, the merch drops to the meetups, girls aren't just watching anymore. We run the fandom now.
No, not bad, huh?
Because following sports, it's not just about the score.
Oh, my God.
It's community.
Oh, my gosh. No, we have to pause this.
We don't just watch. We live it. Meet Halo. Sky Sports' Lil Sis.
Sounds great. Or does it? It was pulled after 3 days when young women complained it was ever so slightly patronising. Kate Mason joined us in the studio, sports writer and broadcaster. Was it patronising?
Pretty patronising, yes, Nick. I mean, it was, the Lil Sis branding was, you're right, an attempt to target younger women, but
and to be clear, it was girls. I mean, it was, well, no, that's it, not it was, code it was for 24-year-olds.
It was the female fan, generally, was the one that they were trying to speak to. And perhaps people listening might think, oh, this seems like a bit of a trivial issue, you know, broadcaster launches TikTok, who cares? But really, what we've seen is a huge online backlash to it, which is what caused this to be dropped after just 3 days, as you say, because it actually cuts to the heart of the frustration that the female sports fan has been feeling for so many years, to be honest, and in this space as well, that you're constantly having to justify yourself and to make people accept you. And then suddenly this brilliant idea completely entrenches the kind of othering of the female fan.
Just explain for people who didn't see it, you know, what really got under your skin? Because I could see, see quite a lot.
Well, I think the main thing, Nick, to be honest, was just that it was a complete lack of thoughtfulness around the kind of content that was being put on there. Sure, all the branding was pink, that's a bit annoying, but also it was just completely unthoughtful. There was an Erling Haaland goal. There was no particular reason why it was that goal. And then it was just added to a meme. It just looked like a slightly brainless way to combine football, and meme culture. And of course, what it didn't come from was within the brilliant content creating industry that exists around both women's football, women's sport in general, and of course, there's brilliant female creators out there.
But is your view as a woman, as a sports writer, as someone looking at the rise, for example, of women's sport, I think it's been very striking, not just obviously women's football, but women's rugby this year, being given much greater prominence, frankly, no longer being stared at in the way I think it was routinely for a very long time, that this isn't necessary. Just run a sports channel.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, but I think this actually epitomises the kind of the gap, I'm afraid, between some of the senior, often male, almost always male leadership of huge sports media organisations. Obviously, this is a hard conversation to have. But, you know, this epitomises that gap between them and the female fandom and the younger women who they really need to attract if they're going to keep making money. They've seen the success of Ilona Meir, and they've seen also that there's been four times as much growth in women's sport than men.
Well, the voice of young women is on the in line, because there's a young woman in your house, Anna. Would she be at all tempted?
My 11-year-old daughter. Do you know what? I would say, and I don't know what you think about this, Kate, is that it's just better to showcase the role models. And Sky's done this really well. They have great female sports presenters. They have fantastic female sports women. You just don't really need to paint it pink to get the kids involved, do you?
Actually, Anna, part of this could be positive, that the outcome from this, because, of course, it's highlighting the great work of some of these content creators who've been talking about this, which you can find very easily if you do open up TikTok. And some of those role models, well, Ilona Meir is obviously the one who's always mentioned. But what I've also noticed today is that Sky Sports on their Instagram channel over the last, let's say, 24 to 48 hours have put over a third of their posts are about female sport. And you might think, oh, it's because it's international break. Well, I checked last international break. There was just one.
You think they've learned the lesson. Right. So plans to turn the Today programme into a pink version. We'll put them on hold, shall we, for the moment. Kate Mason, thank you very much indeed. Here with The Sport, all of it, is Mike.
Yes, Nick, thank you. I'll try and rattle through as much as possible. So the main headlines for the home nations from the ongoing final round of World Cup qualifiers are these. England finished with a perfect 8 wins from 8 after a 2-0 victory in Albania. Captain Harry Kane with both goals. Scotland have set up a massive winner-takes-all clash with Denmark tomorrow. If they can beat the Danes at Hampden, they will qualify automatically for their first World Cup in 27 years. Meanwhile, Wales will secure a home semi-final in the playoffs if they can beat North Macedonia in Cardiff tomorrow. Northern Ireland have also guaranteed their place in the playoffs. But I think we have to talk about the Republic of Ireland. For me, this was the moment of the weekend. They knew they had to beat Hungary to keep their World Cup dream alive. But they were 2-1 down with 10 minutes to play in Budapest. They got it back to 2-2 before this happened in the 97th minute.
One last throw of the dice. It's all on this from Queeby Kelleher. Scales wins the header. The chance! Troy Parrott, that is unbelievable. He scored a hat-trick, and right at the death, Ireland have done it. I've never seen anything like it. Absolutely remarkable. Right at the end, this is just stunning. 3-2, the time is up. The referee has to finish the game. I've no voice left.
The scenes down below is absolutely incredible.
There'll be a statue on Sheriff Street tomorrow for Troy Parrott.
He's not wrong. Troy Parrott's hat-trick goal in the last seconds of injury time, securing a famous 3-2 win for Ireland yesterday. It meant they snatched the second position in the group and a place in the playoffs with the last kick of the match, prompting wild scenes, as we heard on RTE yesterday there. Well, Dan McDonald, football correspondent at the Irish Independent, was inside the stadium, still in Budapest this morning. Hi, Dan.
Morning.
Talk about luck of the Irish. How about that?
Yeah, and I think some people would say there hasn't been a huge amount of luck in recent years. I think the story of this Irish generation of players has largely been near misses and sort of ifs, buts and maybes and sort of, you know, very much on the wrong side of the margins. So I think that's part of the, I suppose, the release in the celebrations was almost surprised that something like this has happened to a group who looked like they were going to be perennial losers, for want of a better term, you know, but that's how they were almost being perceived. So for them to be, you know, on the opposite side of of something that, you know, like that was Ray Houghton was on co-commentary there, who was, you know, scored some of, you know, Ireland's greatest goals on their greatest days. But I think this will compare with them because it was just so unexpected.
And we just have to mention Troy Parrott. He got two on Thursday, didn't he, against Portugal. He called that the greatest night of his life. And then he goes to Budapest and gets a hat-trick in a famous win. I mean, he will never forget the last 5 days, will he?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Like 5 goals in 2 games. That's the first ever away hat-trick by an Irish player in a senior international. So, ever. Like, so when, you know, when you put that into sort of context, and, you know, Troy as well, he's 23, he's left the English game to go to Holland to try and sort of find himself a bit. He's now probably going to move for, you know, a big money. But I mean, he is now someone who just, he, you know, he's on one name terms now, Troy, in the Irish sporting discourse. He has his place. And yeah, for him, I mean, he was injured for the start of the campaign. He came back this week to start 2 games. And I mean, what he's done is, yeah, that's his legend secured, to be honest.
And it keeps the World Cup dream alive for Ireland. For another 5 months or so, they'll find out who they will get in the playoffs on Thursday before that semi-final in March of next year. Dan McDonald, football correspondent at the Irish Independent, many thanks for your time. Anna and Nick, you may have seen yesterday, Dublin Airport jokingly put a post on social media saying that they were renaming themselves to the Troy Parrott International Airport yesterday. Incredible.
Wonderful bit of commentary. Thanks, Mike.
He had green hair and very bad teeth.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Join Gina Birch from the Raincoast.
I saw firsthand how their magnetism tore through British culture.
And me, Steve Lamack, as we explore one of Britain's most notorious bands.
4 members, no egos.
That shocked the nation.
They are the antithesis of humankind.
Defined punk and tore themselves apart.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Search Sex Pistols on BBC Sounds.
Do you know, if you get a moment this morning, I do recommend watching that airport clip that Mike was talking about, not least to see the guy who jumps around and celebrates wildly while not letting go of his wheelie case, which is some quite athletic and impressive gymnastics that he manages to do. It's very, very good. Today, weather-wise, largely dry, chilly. There should be some sunshine around for most. Northern Scotland and eastern coastal areas may see a few light showers.
It is 26 minutes to 8. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna in Salford and me in London and Caroline Nichols. As a summary of the news.
The government will today publish the full details of its overhaul of the asylum system, including plans to change human rights laws to make it easier to deport people who are in the UK illegally. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, wants to curb repeat appeals against removal and limit the use of the right to family life in asylum cases. President Trump has urged Republicans in the House of Representatives to support a bill that would force the release of all unclassified government files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Trump has been under pressure from his own party to make the material public. The United States says it will list the Venezuelan criminal network, known as the Cartel de los Soles, as a foreign terrorist organisation, a move that will allow Washington to target the group and its alleged associates more aggressively. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, claims President Nicolas Maduro leads the organisation, which he denies. A court in Bangladesh is delivering its verdict against the former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who's been tried in absentia for crimes against humanity. The case centres on a crackdown on student-led protests that toppled her government last year. Sheikh Hasina, who denies all charges, fled to India, where she remains. Authorities in eastern Ukraine say 3 people have been killed in Russian missile strikes in the Kharkiv region. Russian state media says its air defences destroyed 36 Ukrainian drones overnight. President Zelensky is in France for talks with President Macron about European military support for Kyiv. A couple from Hertfordshire who were arrested in January after raising concerns about their daughter's primary school on a WhatsApp group say police have now paid them £20,000 in damages. Maxie Allen told this programme the force's admission of fault felt like vindication, while his wife, Rosalind Levine, said she no longer trusted the police at all. Hertfordshire police said at the time the arrests were necessary to investigate allegations of harassment and malicious communications.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 24 minutes to 8 now. Donald Trump has executed a spectacular U-turn. He's now calling for the Epstein files to be published after weeks attacking members of his own party who were demanding just that. The U-turn comes days before the president was facing what looked increasingly likely to be a humiliating defeat in the House of Representatives, with some warning that 100 congressmen would defy Mr. Trump. Before we came on air, I spoke to the Republican Congressman Glenn Groofman from Wisconsin, who sits on the powerful House Oversight Committee, which is the committee leading efforts to make those files public. I asked him what he thinks explains the president's change of mind.
Well, I think he, in part, felt that rather than go through a systematic release of files by the House Oversight Committee and all the speculation that goes with it, he saw what was going on was that rather than focusing on our appropriation bills and our budget for next year, which we should, the press was just focusing on the Epstein files. The second thing is, well, he has many, many loyal congressmen out there prepared to go about things more methodically. It was a difficult vote for them, and I don't think he wanted to put them through a tough vote back home. So he switched gears and just said, we'll release it all and let the press go nuts for a couple of days, and then we're going to be focusing back on the budget as we should.
Isn't the truth that he was warned that 100 Republicans were about to change sides and he was going to lose the vote?
Well, he didn't know I was going to change sides. I haven't talked to him, so I would be surprised if 100 people called in and told him that.
He was warned publicly, wasn't he, on TV. Now, why did you change your mind? What was it that your constituents were telling you?
Well, I never publicly said or privately said exactly how I'm going to vote. So, you know, obviously the majority of people would like to see them released. But I'd be happy to listen to Mike Johnson's opinion as to why they shouldn't be released. I'd be surprised if 100 people had made up their mind, actually. But
there are a huge number of things concerning your constituents, the cost of living, other important issues. Why has the release of this tranche of files taken on such significance?
Well, I think it's something the press loves to focus on. You know, the press loves to focus on the prurient, you know. They like to focus on the smut. The press will focus on that rather than important things in the budget, which is very frustrating for people like me, because right now America is so wildly in debt. But the reason we can't get the public excited on an individual line in the budget is they would rather deal with this personal sort of stuff. I mean, you'll have to ask me why the BBC is interviewing about the Epstein files rather than why we have 600,000 non-military personnel in the military. You know, you're the one who decided to interview me on the Epstein files. I don't think it's significant as hundreds of thousands of people sitting on their butts doing very little in the Department of Defense, but you think it is. That's why it's something that is garnering national attention.
It's a fair question, but it's also true that the president has gone to war with his own supporters. Marjorie Taylor Greene, called a traitor, wacky, and a raving lunatic for calling for these files to be released. It made people think that maybe he had something to hide, didn't it?
Well, I think that was the speculation. That's another reason why I released him. I think when he releases him, you'll find he had nothing to hide. But rather than going through things methodically, as apparently the president originally did, and letting the House Oversight Committee do its work, he realized that the press was solely going to focus on this until everything was released, and so that's what he's doing.
Will this vote, when it comes, end it, Congressman, or will there still be a battle over Senate approval and to be sure that the president will not veto any bill down the track?
Well, I would think it would be the end of it, only because if every Republican congressman votes for it, it's going to be hard to justify the Senate not taking it up.
And finally, do you believe that once these files are released after some days of fuss, but do you believe that will end the matter, or do you think there are things in those files that will have America regretting the way their leaders have behaved?
Well, you know, I don't know what you mean by leaders. You know, there may be sports figures, there may be Hollywood figures, there may be media figures. And, you know, maybe there are politicians in there. Maybe there's a U.S. senator. I don't know. Obviously, if a U.S. senator or something like that, a politician is caught in the files, their reputation will be hopefully permanently damaged. On the other hand, you look at a guy like Bill Clinton, who is probably personal behavior is about the most reprehensible of any president we've ever had, and the Democrats still put him up there every 4 years at their convention. So maybe the public will care. Maybe the public cares less than the press thinks they care.
Do you think the president is right to say he has nothing to hide?
I assume so. I mean, you know, I think this. Somebody's been looking at these files, right? The Biden administration had access to the files, I believe. And I think if there's anything horrible about President Trump, that would have come out already.
Congressman Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Love talking to the wonderful people in the home country.
Always good to hear. 18 minutes to 8. Now, the team at Kew Gardens have a dilemma on their hands at the moment, because as they start to renovate the famous Palm House, a giant 11-metre Ranvenia moriae tree that has dominated the space is now actually in the way. But it's too big to move, and it can't be propagated either, because Kew's specimen is a male. There isn't a female to produce seed. In fact, for years, scientists feared that the species was actually extinct in the wild, but a few were discovered clinging on in the Comoros Islands off the coast of East Africa. Professor Bill Baker is senior research leader at Kew, basically their palm expert. Professor, hello.
Hello, good morning.
This is an extraordinary story, and in fact, the picture of it on Kew's website just shows how huge and magnificent it is, but now a bit of a problem. What to do with it?
Yeah, it is indeed a dilemma. We have to renovate our iconic palm house. It is deteriorating. It hasn't been renovated since the 1980s, and it needs some love. But I realised quite early on in the process that we had this one particular problem with this remarkable palm, probably the most important individual palm in the collection. As you said, it's a male. It cannot be propagated. You can't make a cutting from it, and it's a critically endangered species on the IUCN Red List. And we'd heard so little about it for many, many years from the wild that I was really, really concerned that this could be the last individual on the planet, and the palm house renovation would end up making a whole species extinct. And that was obviously something that could not happen.
Yeah, I'm going to ask what's going to sound like a really basic layman's question, but I think sometimes that's a good thing. When we say it's too big to move, huge things can be moved. They can be dug up and shifted. Is it because it's too delicate? Is it to do with a root structure? Why do we say it's too big to move?
Well, it's a combination of the palm itself and also the physical environment. So actually getting it out through the palm house doors would be extremely difficult, and it would mean tilting it over, which would almost certainly lead to a kind of, well, the fancy way of putting it is a catastrophic failure of the stem. Actually, palms can be moved in some circumstances, but I think we feel that this one has just taken up so much space in the palm house now and is so settled in that it will inevitably object fatally if we start trying to dig it up.
So what happens? Is it the end?
No, it's not the end, because the main thing that came out of this issue is that we've spent two major expeditions in the Comoro Islands with a fantastic set of partners from the university there and from Karthala National Park. And we have explored widely throughout the Comoro Islands for this palm. We found just 50 individuals left in the wild in our surveys. Only 12 of those were adults. And the wonderful thing is that by being there, we've really fired up some enthusiasm in the Comoros. And now we see the university has developed a nursery and is cultivating these palms. They're planning to put them out in the urban landscape, to make sure that people become more aware of their natural patrimony. We've also managed to bring just a few plants back to Kew. So we're going to be able to, when we've restored the palm house, when it's fully renovated in about 5 years' time, we'll be able to plant this palm back, and we'll be able to tell a fantastic story about how the palm house renovation also led to some really important conservation science.
Yeah, a story of new life. It's a brilliant tale. Thank you so much for telling us about it, Professor Bill Baker. Thank you.
At 14 minutes to 8, it's now time for Thought for the Day with Professor Tina Bailey, writer and Catholic theologian.
Good morning. This month, millions of toxic plastic beads have been released into the sea due to a failure at a wastewater processing plant in East Sussex. The beads have been washing up along the shore from Dungeness to Rye Harbour Nature Reserve. This coastline is a site of special scientific interest, home to a rich diversity of birds and marine life. Thousands of migrating birds are arriving to overwinter in the salt marshes and lakes. The pristine beach at Camber Sands has been particularly badly affected. Volunteers have joined the local community for a clean-up operation, digging through seaweed and sand on their hands and knees, using a makeshift assortment of sieves and buckets to attempt to gather up the beads. It seems like a hopeless task. We moved to Camber 5 years ago. In summer, it's a flourishing holiday resort with multicultural crowds wearing an assortment of beach garb from burkas to bikinis, attracted by its miles of beach and sparkling seas in the shelter of the dunes. In winter, it's a place of haunting and beautiful isolation, where one can walk for hours without encountering anyone other than the occasional dog walker. On the other side of the planet, world leaders are gathering in Brazil for COP30 to negotiate over their environmental obligations. Representatives of indigenous communities have been joined by climate activists demanding action. Those who have the power to act must be held to account, but none of us is entirely powerless. That's why I see those people on Camber Beach with their sieves and buckets as a sign of hope. There's something both absurd and inspiring about what they're doing. Absurd because the challenge is so vast. Inspiring because they've refused to succumb to despair and defeat. Poet and priest Gerard Manley Hopkins lamented that all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. But his poem, God's Grandeur, doesn't give the last word to the merchants of destruction. He reminds us that for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. From Belém in Brazil to Camber in East Sussex, when people act together, our small acts of loving care for the environment are more than the sum of their parts. I believe they link us in mysterious ways to the love of God for creation. As Hopkins reminds us, the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with our bright wings.
That was Thought for the Day with Professor Tina Beattie, writer and Catholic theologian. It's just coming round to 10 to 8 now. The UN's humanitarian chief has told this programme the international community needs to do more to stop the supply of weapons to the conflict in Sudan. Tom Fletcher has called on leaders to do some courageous, creative diplomacy, in his words, and he says that he will take that message to the UN Security Council. He spent the last week travelling to Darfur at the heart of the war. It's a place that's very difficult to get to. It's subject to a communications blackout, particularly around Al-Fashir, and it is one of the reasons why this conflict perhaps doesn't always get the attention internationally that it should. And Tom Fletcher told me about some of the civilians that he'd met there who'd been caught up in what is now one of the world's worst humanitarian crises.
It's utterly grim right now. It's desperate. And I think Darfur is the epicentre of global inhumanity right now. And I'm meeting survivors of massacre. Survivors of mass rapes. A woman I met 2 days ago in Tawila, a young woman, she'd seen her husband murdered in front of her. She'd escaped. Her neighbour had been murdered. She'd managed to scoop up the young, malnourished child of her neighbour and carry the child all the way to Tawila from Al-Fashir. But on the way, she'd been attacked and her leg had been broken. I didn't ask her about the details of how that happened, but I think you can probably fill in the blanks. And somehow she managed to escape again. And yet she's somehow the lucky one because she got to us. She got to our medical center and the child is being looked after. The child will survive despite being severely malnourished. And she will survive. But she's saying, what happens when they come here? And she's also asking, where is the help? You know, where is the world?
There are people who are making it to Tawila, as you say, but there are lots of people who aren't. Tens of thousands of people who seem to be missing, who just aren't managing to leave Al-Fashir or aren't managing to get to the point at which you can help them.
That's exactly right. And that's a serious worry for us. So in Tawila, we have hundreds of thousands already and tens of thousands arriving. But the numbers arriving aren't as great as they should be, given the brutality that has been experienced in Al-Fashir and the atrocities that have been committed. So we're very, very worried about the numbers that are being held there. We want to get our investigation teams in urgently, and that's been part of the reason for me being here, is to negotiate the access for our teams. And of course, we want to get those life-saving aid convoys into Al-Fashir. We want to see the UN flag and our humanitarian partners inside El Fasha, responding as best we can to the needs of the survivors.
What kind of conversations have you been having with the RSF? Do you think you've managed to make any progress with them?
So I've been having very tough conversations with the authorities in Port Sudan, but also with the RSF here. I've been in Darfur for just under a week now, which is a long time to be going through their checkpoints. I've encountered many of them, of course, and in Korma yesterday, which is a town very close to El Fasha. And I've been saying to them that we will demand investigations. We will demand accountability for the atrocities that have been committed. We're insisting on protection of civilians. The atrocities have to stop. But we're also setting out our conditions under which we'll start to be able to get aid into El Fasha. Now, I'm getting assurances in Port Sudan from the authorities there, from the RSF, that we will be allowed to deliver our aid everywhere without hindrance or impediment. And the reason I wanted to come myself over this week was to test those commitments, to really see if we can stand up those commitments and make sure that that interference doesn't happen. But it's an incredibly complex operating environment. It's taken me over 2 days to get here. It will take over 2 days to get back to the Adrae border into Chad. We've gone through tens of checkpoints manned, or I should say run by children, actually, from different military factions. And on the way, you know, we had an airstrike on one of our UN convoys that was just behind us. On the way out just now, we've come through a pretty nasty forest fire. So you get a real sense of the challenge of reaching these people.
As you describe, it's an enormously dangerous place at the moment. And when you have those conversations with the RSF, what reasoning are they giving you for cutting off El Fasha from the world, for not allowing humanitarian aid in? Why do they tell you they're doing that?
Well, they explain it as part of a long-running conflict. They set themselves up in a certain way in responding to the conflict. But they are now saying, as a result of the meeting and the contacts I've had with them this week, that we can have that access. We're insisting on getting our investigators in, on getting aid in a neutral, impartial way. We're not going to have our aid instrumentalized. We're not going to have it manipulated in a way that doesn't meet the needs of the survivors. So it's a very complex negotiation. We've also got to get safe passages out of El Fasha for the survivors who want to escape, but also safe passages in for our humanitarian workers who are running massive risks being here and need to be closer to the people we serve.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has called for international action to try and cut off the supply of weapons to the RSF. The Sudanese army and others say that it's the United Arab Emirates that's doing that. They have denied it. But in terms of trying to deal with that, what can be done?
Well, the last thing Sudan needs right now is more guns and bullets, frankly. It needs a massive surge in life-saving aid. We're only 28% funded on the appeals here. You know, all I'm asking for globally, by the way, is 1% of what the world spends on arms. And so I think any country involved in this conflict has to think very, very carefully about their responsibilities. There will have to be accountability for all those who've carried out these atrocities. But also we need the international community now to actually come together and do some courageous, creative diplomacy here. I can't believe that this conflict is so difficult, so complex that we can't stop it. And that's a message I'll be taking back again to the Security Council. Stop the arms flows coming in and start to do some proper diplomacy. Start to do your work.
I know that you're in Sudan at the moment, Tom, but I wanted to ask you while we're speaking about something which we have talked to you so many times about over the last couple of years, and that is Gaza. Because UNRWA have said that despite the ceasefire and despite the conditions of that ceasefire, there is still not enough aid being allowed into Gaza by Israel. What is your understanding of what's happening there?
So conditions are still very tough for us. We're about halfway through the 60-day plan that I laid out just before I spent a few days in Gaza last month. And we are making progress. We're getting in a lot more aid than we were before. We're feeding millions of people. We are getting tents in, tens of thousands of tents a week. We're getting kids back into education. We're starting to stand up the health centres again. But this is not enough. We need more crossings open. We only have the two now, three as of a couple of days ago, crossings open. We need all of those crossings open. We need NGO access. Our NGO partners are crucial for delivery on the ground. And we need that massive surge of generosity from the international community. You know, I come on and I talk to you about these human stories. And I feel increasingly angry and frustrated that at the scale of these aid cuts and at politicians going around boasting about aid cuts, as they say, all I'm asking is 1% of what the world spends on defence, and we can really stand up a decent response to these crises. It infuriates me that we're seeing so many cuts and that there's, and that the public's not out there demanding greater generosity.
Tom Fletcher in Darfur, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Anna.
Well, it's time now to hear about new comedy starting tomorrow on Radio 4.
Enter the world of online reviews.
Unless you want to wake up screaming in the middle of the night, avoid.
Frank Skinner shares, one person found this helpful.
Who on earth is suspicious of a pen?
Oh, Joe, you sound very gullible right now.
With guests including Joe Caulfield, Ed Byrne and Pierre Novelli.
So I found a stress relief scream jar, but it's also known as an anger management shouting vase. One of the best reviews, 2 stars, get a pillow.
The new series of One Person Found This Helpful with me, Frank Skinner, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow night at 6:30.
Let's check the weather forecast with snow on the horizon for some of us at least. Morning, Simon King.
Yeah, good morning, Anna. Yes, some of us, Anna, will get some snow over the next couple of days, but all of us will notice how cold it's going to feel as Arctic air spreads in for most of the UK. So this morning's quite a chilly start, and in southeast England, eastern and northeast England, we've got some showers moving in on that rather brisk northerly wind. Some of those showers turning a little bit wintry over the North York Moors, but it is just rain down to low levels. Some of those showers could move their way a bit further inland, but for most, actually, it's going to be a sunny day, maximum temperatures getting up to about 7 to 10 degrees. In southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northwest England, well, it's a cold start, a bit of frost around. It's dry though, clear spells, lots of sunshine expected all day with highs of 5 to 9 Celsius. For Northern Ireland today, it's quite chilly out there this morning, but again, lots of sunshine throughout most of the day. The cloud though will start to increase a bit later this afternoon with highs of 6 to 8 Celsius. And for Scotland, again, just a little bit of frost first thing this morning. Dry with sunny spells for most, but for northern and eastern Scotland, here we will see some showers moving in. Again, those could be a little bit wintry over the higher ground. The cloud will start to increase a bit towards the northern and west areas later on this afternoon, highs of 3 to 7 Celsius. And it's through tonight where cloud will spread to many parts, and with that there'll be some rain into western Scotland and Northern Ireland. Some of that will turn to snow over higher ground. Clearer skies though in eastern Scotland, northeast England, temperatures here down to -4, -5 Celsius.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Monday the 17th of November. The headlines this morning, the Home Secretary is to set out her proposed overhaul of the asylum system, including changes to human rights laws, limits on appeals and fast-track deportation. After the news, we'll speak to the Home Office Minister and the Labour MP for Folkestone, who wants the government to think again. President Trump has told Republicans in the House of Representatives to vote in favour of releasing files relating to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And a couple who were arrested after criticising their child's primary school have said they feel vindicated after they were paid damages by police.
And also coming up, now the Treasury say they won't be putting up income tax rates. Could a mansion tax be on the cards? Kirsty Allsop and a policymaker will discuss whether that really is the solution. And the psychologist for the England cricket team talks to Mike ahead of the Ashes. Yeah, they're starting on Friday.
No escaping the tension, but just getting excited and often reminding yourself, where would you want to be? And I want to be the person that faces that first ball in an Ashes test.
If they're not watching the cricket, then the kids should be reading, shouldn't they? We'll be discussing why just 1 in 3 say they enjoy reading in their spare time, and we'll be asking what can be done to reverse the trend. That's all after the BBC News read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Human rights laws are to be changed as part of the government's overhaul of the asylum system, with new measures introduced to make it easier to deport illegal migrants. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, will set out a raft of new policies in the House of Commons this afternoon. She said that tackling illegal migration is a moral mission, but the plans are likely to meet with opposition from within Labour. Our political correspondent, Joe Pike, reports.
The latest announcement in Shabana Mahmood's sweeping overhaul of the immigration system is new legislation to change how Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights is applied in migration court cases. It protects the right to family life, but the government wants it to apply only to close families such as parents or children, and wants judges to give more weight to the wider public interest. Ministers hope the reforms will make deportations easier. The Home Secretary also plans to change the law so those refused asylum can't make multiple appeals, and she is threatening Angola, Namibia and the Democratic Republic of the Congo with visa restrictions if they don't accept the return of their criminals and illegal immigrants. The government is billing these proposals as the most significant reforms to the asylum system in decades, but there is already some scepticism in government and on Labour's backbenches. One MP has told the BBC these plans are a step too far. Another said they had big reservations. Both the Conservatives and Reform UK have expressed doubts as to whether the plans will ever get through the Commons.
President Trump has called on Republicans in the lower house of Congress to release government files on the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein in a change from his previous position. Mr. Trump has come under pressure from within his own Republican Party to release the files, something he said he would do when he was campaigning for the White House. The president has been posting on social media, as Tom Simons reports.
Donald Trump said, "We have nothing to hide," and Republicans in the House of Representatives should vote to release the files. The House Oversight Committee is investigating the US federal government's handling of the Epstein case. Mr. Trump said, "It should have whatever it's legally entitled to. I don't care," he posted in capitals. It's a reversal of position as, slowly but surely, the political tide turns in favour of full disclosure of the files. The Democrats on the Oversight Committee published selected emails mentioning Donald Trump last week. The House is preparing to vote on a bill which would result in everything being released. Yesterday, a co-sponsor of the bill said 100 members of the president's own party could now back it.
The Republican Congressman, Glenn Grothman, who's on the House Oversight Committee, told us why he thought the president had changed his mind.
He realized that the press was solely going to focus on this until everything was released. The second thing is, he has many, many loyal congressmen out there prepared to go about things more methodically. It was a difficult vote for them, and I don't think he wanted to put them through a tough vote back home. So he switched gears and just said, we'll release it all and let the press go nuts for a couple of days.
In the past few minutes, a court in Bangladesh has convicted the former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina of crimes against humanity over a crackdown on student-led protests against her last year. The UN says it left 1,400 people dead. Sheikh Hasina was tried in absentia, having fled to India when the protests toppled her government. The United States says it will declare a Venezuelan criminal group, which it claims includes the president, Nicolas Maduro, as a foreign terrorist organisation. There's been growing speculation of a possible US military attack on Venezuela. American defence officials say they've deployed the world's biggest aircraft carrier to the Caribbean Sea to tackle drug trafficking. 80 people have been killed in weeks of strikes against what the US has described as narco-terrorists in the region. Here's our South America correspondent, Ione Wells.
The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. would designate the Cartel de los Soles as a foreign terrorist organization. Washington claims it is a criminal group involved in drug trafficking and led by the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, which he strongly denies. The U.S. hasn't published evidence publicly of his direct involvement in trafficking, but its characterization of Mr. Maduro is seen as a way for the U.S. to possibly justify targeting him or those close to him as part of its military campaign against drug trafficking. Last night, Donald Trump said he thought Venezuela would like to have talks with the United States. In a blow to the US, though, people in Ecuador voted against allowing foreign military bases in the country again, something the US had been hoping would bolster its operations in the Eastern Pacific.
A couple from Hertfordshire who were arrested in January after making complaints about their daughter's primary school on a WhatsApp group say police have paid them £20,000 in damages. At the time, the force said the arrests were necessary to investigate allegations of harassment and malicious communications. Maxie Allen told us he, his wife and their two young daughters had been put through the ringer that day, and he was pleased they'd been vindicated.
I think overall we were just really pleased that Hertfordshire Constabulary have recognised that this shouldn't have happened and recognised that they made quite a serious mistake. I mean, obviously they paid damages and they paid costs. But for us, the main thing really was the liability that the arrest was unlawful. That's what mattered most to us.
A BBC investigation has uncovered evidence which casts doubt on the American inquiry into the killing of 24 Iraqi civilians in Haditha in 2005. The massacre, which was carried out by US Marines, led to one of the Iraq War's longest war crimes investigations, but no convictions. Lara El-Ghabali has more details.
In November 2005, a US convoy in Haditha was struck by an IED, killing one Marine and injuring two others. In the hours that followed, Marines shot four students on their way to college, then entered three homes, killing nearly everyone inside. The youngest victim was just 3 years old. An investigation took place, and a trial finished 6 years later, but no one was convicted of carrying out the killings. Now, 2 decades later, BBC I has uncovered a recording which, according to a senior forensic investigator, places one Marine in the room where a family of seven was shot and killed, a room that the Marine initially claimed not to have entered. He was never charged with the crime and maintained he never shot women and children. The Marine Corps has told the BBC it is committed to fair and open proceedings as set out under US military law.
Police say organised gangs are using increasingly advanced methods to steal cargo from lorries across the UK. A BBC investigation has found that in some cases, criminals are buying legitimate haulage companies, collecting loads for delivery and then disappearing with the goods. Elizabeth Glinker reports.
Police say criminals are using increasingly targeted and sophisticated methods to infiltrate supply chains. In one example investigated by the BBC, a lorry load of DIY products was stolen. A bogus company posed as a legitimate delivery firm and made off with goods worth more than £75,000. We discovered that the firm had been bought in the name of a lorry driver who had died months earlier. The National Police Chiefs Council says it's facing more sophisticated operators. Additional funding has been put into intelligence to target freight crime.
Technology, which was originally developed for Formula One cars, is being used to try to improve Wi-Fi on trains. A pilot scheme will use a hybrid system of signals from both phone masts and satellites to create superfast connections on board. Our business correspondent Mark Ashdown has more details.
With average download speeds of around a megabit per second, one study ranked the UK as one of the worst major European and Asian nations for train Wi-Fi. A 60-day pilot scheme aims to change that. An intercity express train on Great Western Railway, which runs from London Paddington to Penzance, will use a hybrid of mobile phone masts on the ground with low Earth orbit satellites to create a more reliable connection. The technology was first developed for Formula One cars, and the company behind it said switching between the ground and space-based networks would reduce dropouts in signal. In last year's spending review, the government committed £41 million to introduce low Earth orbit satellite connectivity on all mainline trains by 2030.
Mark Ashdown reporting.
Caroline, thank you. It's 8:10. Are you listening carefully? The government wants you to hear their new message on asylum, and not just you. They want their message to be heard by asylum seekers waiting on the coast of France or thinking of heading there. The message is simple. We're going to tighten the law to make it easier to deport failed asylum seekers, says the Home Secretary. We're going to make it easier to deport people by punishing countries which refuse to take back their citizens. We'll block visas for legal migration from those countries. And they say even people who are granted asylum and have lived here for up to 20 years could be sent home if the place they fled from becomes safer. That package of tough-sounding measures has been briefed out for day after day, but it is meeting opposition. We'll speak to the minister responsible in just a moment, but first, though, let's hear from the Labour MP and immigration lawyer Tony Vaughan, KC MP, for Folkestone, who tweeted last night that ministers need to think again.
I totally agree with Shabana that there is public trust ebbing away from our asylum system, and we have to regain that trust. But the problem I have with this is that I think it is taking the wrong turn. I mean, the particular problem that I have is around the idea that we should be trying to kick refugees out despite having granted them protection. I think the idea is that we review their status after 2.5 years on a kind of rolling basis, so then hopefully at some point their countries will be safe and we can deport them. I think that is completely the wrong position in principle. We need to be making sure that if the system has decided applying the immigration controls that somebody should be granted asylum. We should be welcoming and integrating and not creating this situation of kind of perpetual limbo and alienation, which doesn't help the refugees and it doesn't help society.
But if, for example, people have come here from Syria and the regime falls, as it has, and Syria is a safer country, what is wrong with saying to people, well, we were delighted to give you refuge, but now is a time when you should consider going home?
In the case of something like Ukraine, I mean, that has been the approach that has been taken. But the problem here is that if you're taking it as a system-wide principle, it means that you're going to have refugees who are sort of looked at persistently, consistently, as people who do not belong. And if the policy of immigration and asylum system is to integrate, then it completely fails that test.
What do you say to your constituents, though? You are the MP for Folkestone, who want to see fewer boats coming across the Channel. And they're being told by ministers the only real way of doing that is to be able to have a deterrence and to deport people quicker.
Look, as I said, we have to have public confidence in our asylum system. I completely agree about that. But the way to do this is to build on the work that's already being done. I support the UK-France deal. That is a safe way in for people so they don't have to make dangerous crossings. And it's a way out for people who have decided not to do that. Now, you know, there are government attempts to create other agreements of that nature, which could scale that up and reduce that incentive. But taking an approach which is essentially trying to take status away from people who, you know, ultimately need to integrate as refugees, if we've accepted that, is the wrong approach in principle. And it will also cost a lot of money, which could be better spent doing other things.
As well as being a Member of Parliament, you are an immigration lawyer. You're a KC, a barrister, in other words. What do you say to the Home Secretary who wants to tighten human rights laws to make it harder to appeal against deportation and wants to curb the number of appeals to make it easier to deport people?
The numbers of people who are prevented from return by the Strasbourg court are very, very small. And we need to be realistic about what those sorts of reforms are going to achieve. And we can't promise the public things which it's not going to deliver. The way to solve the politically salient challenge of small boats arriving on our shores is to ensure that making things like the UK-France deal work by sorting out the asylum accommodation problem, by sorting out the appeal backlog. The appeal backlog is one of the factors that is growing at the largest rate, and we need to decide claims quicker, not spend money on reassessing status after 2.5 years or so. I want us to rebuild trust in our asylum system, but I think we have to take a really clear-eyed approach and not sort of go down the road of rhetoric, but actually focus on actual measures that are going to disincentivize and cut the backlogs and cut the delays in our system, which are causing the public disquiet that we are all seeing.
Tony Vaughan, KC, immigration lawyer and Labour MP for Folkestone. Listening to that, the Minister of State for Border Security and Asylum, Alex Norris, joins us. Good morning to you, Mr. Norris.
Morning, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you. And there's a big package of things, so let's take it one at a time, if we could. The specific thing that seems to have really upset Mr. Vaughan is the idea that asylum should be temporary. He and others fear that refugees who are granted asylum status could be in a form of permanent limbo, being waiting for the moment at which they could be turfed out of their homes, out of their jobs, or their children ripped out of their schools. Why is that the right thing to do?
Well, first of all, Nick, you know, we need to focus on what challenge we're trying to address here. We're, you know, the British public rightly have become fed up of the lack of control of our borders, of people who jump the queue for support in this country, for the impact that has on their community. We're an open, generous and tolerant nation, but it needs to be done in an ordered way. And we have to address the fundamental question, why are asylum claims falling across Europe at the same time as they're increasing in the UK? That's why we're making the announcement today, which is the biggest package in modern times. Firstly, to dissuade people from making those illegal journeys, and I'll, you know, address Tony's comments in a second. Secondly, to make sure that people don't have a legitimate reason to be here. It's easier to remove them from the country. And then thirdly, to establish safe and legal routes so that people aren't making dangerous journeys across the continent, aren't making dangerous journeys across the Channel. And I think that's okay. The right thing to do. And
that's the package. Let's go through it one at a time, as I was suggesting. Now you've outlined overall the package. Why is it right for someone from Syria or Afghanistan or wherever on the planet to be in a state of permanent limbo, unable to be confident that they can carry on with their life because this government might say, sorry, you've got to go home.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of elements to this, Nick. Firstly, Tony hasn't seen the package yet. I'll say that gently. I share a lot of his goals for the system. I know that he wants a good asylum system that people have confidence in. In the case that you're talking about, that would be an individual who's chosen to come to this country illegally. So they've come through, you know, one of those routes already and broken, you know, a pretty fundamental rule of the system, not going via a safe and legal route, which would be a way to avoid that. But also for an individual who then sits on that reduced protection offer that will be, of course, I don't think it's unreasonable to make sure that the reasons for their sanctuary, which we've always met our obligations and we always will, that they may change, but that individual...
Can I be clear, are you saying this would only apply to new arrivals, that people already in the country will not be affected by this temporary status?
Yes, well, absolutely.
Only new arrivals
would be affected. That's, you know, people now looking, as you said, that making that journey.
Rick, okay, just to be clear, though, the worry that some charities have is that you'll see a repeat of the Windrush scandal, which is confusion about someone's papers could mean that someone who is a doctor or a nurse, someone who's a public servant whose children are at school, nevertheless find themselves having ripped up by the roots and told you've got to go home after being here, not just for years, but two decades. That's just not practical, is it?
That won't be the case. You know, the example that you used there would be an individual who's come to the country illegally. So that already, you know, a lot, you know, we want people to come via safe and legal routes. So that would remove that cohort. But also those individuals who are on that 20-year route to settlement, we will give them the chance to switch to work or study routes so that they are learning English, so that they are taking part in the economy, so that they're contributing, you know, to their own lives and to British society. And if they do that, they can earn their right to settlement like, you know, like others on work and study routes do already.
Would it be honest quickly to say, Mr. Doris, this would probably apply to almost nobody. What you're trying to do is send out a big, tough message that says, look, we're mean enough to turn someone out after 20 years. It won't happen on a scale. It hasn't happened in any other country on a significant scale, has it?
No, Nick, I can't accept that characterisation.
Well, it's not happened in Denmark,
but what we are saying to people is that if your intention, and let's not forget, I'm afraid, that of those who have successful claims, 50% of them end up on benefits. If your intention is to come to the country illegally to, you know, have a claim assessed, and if you're successful, then sit at home, not contribute, not, you know, learn English, integrate into community, not to build a life away from, you know, the dreadful circumstances that you may have come from, then that is going to come with much greater checks. Now, I don't want anybody to do that, but we do know that that does happen. And this is a very practical way of making sure that it doesn't in the future.
Let's turn
and
to
I
human
think
rights
finds
law.
That balance. Could,
forgive me, but you've talked about two bits of human rights law that you think need altering. So-called Article 8, which is the right to family life, so-called Article 3, where people can appeal against inhumane and degrading treatment. How many cases now in the system are there of asylum seekers whose case is rejected but cannot be deported because they use human rights laws? What's the scale of this problem?
In terms of the scale, you know, we are supporting a population of multiple tens of thousands who have no right to be here, you know, having gone through the full system, and now we cannot remove from this country primarily, though not exclusively, because of those human rights claims that are being made.
Do you reject the estimates that I'm seeing in front of me here that it's only 2.5% of the number who were deported who challenge their deportation using, for example, the right to family life, Article 8? Less than 1,000 people.
Well, I probably wouldn't challenge the number itself, but what I would challenge is the impact that that has on the wider system. You know, for example, one of the things that the previous Home Secretary and this Home Secretary have changed at pace is that the government's legal appetite for pushing claims has been reduced because there's a sense that the courts will not rule in our favour.
Just to be clear, I think I know what you're saying. I just want to be really clear. What you're saying is don't judge this by the numbers who are successful, but by, as it were, the kind of cloud over the whole system that they might be successful. Is that your argument?
Yeah, I think that's entirely reasonable to say. So, you know, we have pushed that much harder. That's why we've removed 50,000 people with no right to be here, including 5,000 foreign criminals, which is at a 10-year high. So we are pushing this, you know, already that's shown that kind of, that's the impact that it's been having on the system. But we want to go much further.
Can we turn to timetable? Changing Article 8 requires a change in the law. Changing Article 3 requires building an international coalition of countries that agree to change the European Convention on Human Rights. None of this is going to happen at all quickly, is it? This is years of work, not weeks, not months.
Well, Nick, that's wrong. You know, the reality is the package that we're announcing today has a mixture of things. Of course, some of them have a long lead-in time. We're going to change the appeal system so people can't game it and, you know, 6 months down the line, having said they were 32, say they're 16, or after having 15 opportunities to say that they're a victim of modern slavery, then say when they're waiting for deportation, they're victims of modern slavery. We're going to have a much more streamlined one-stop approach on appeals, but of course that takes primary legislation.
But the things I described do take time.
Indeed, but we do know that right now there are messages on social media platforms from human traffickers who make their money by inducing people to travel to this country in small boat, and they are saying, come to the UK because you'll be housed in a hotel and you'll be able to work illegally. Well, we are squeezing down on both of those things, and that is a now thing. Similarly, we know that we have significant numbers of people who have no right to be in this country, and you know we cannot remove them because our returns agreements or our bilateral relationships with different countries are not functioning as they should. So we're making that change now to say to those countries, accept your citizens who don't have a right to be here back, or there will be diplomatic consequences, there'll be visa consequences.
Right, so Mr. Norris, let me just end with a thought on the politics of this, because it's clear that part of what happens in immigration policy is you want to send messages out. You've been clear. You want to get messages to those asylum seekers to say, don't even think about it. You won't be welcome when you're here. You get sent back quickly. That is a legitimate thing to do. What do you say, though, to Mr. Vaughan and many of your colleagues who say you're also sending a message out to people who are legitimately here having escaped war or torture or worse? What you're saying is not welcome here. And they fear you're sending a message to the rest of the population to look at those people with suspicion, to regard them as not welcome, as cheats, as illegals, as people who should be hounded out of their accommodation. Do you worry about that?
I don't think that's a fair characterisation at all, and that is not the message that we're expressing. You know, when you have low public confidence, that's when people start to, you know, make perhaps unfair or superficial assessments. If we restore border order and control at our borders, you know, it's the government's job to do it, then we can have the system we all want. Because I know I want the same thing that Tony wants, which is a safe system, is an ordered system so people are coming in a controlled way, and is one that meets our, you know, decades-long commitment as a generous, open, tolerant country. I've seen this in my own city, you know, whether it's Syria, Afghanistan, Ukraine, Hong Kong. You know, the British people step up when they think it's fair and ordered. That's the system we're making. We will always stand up for people who need that shelter when they're fleeing persecution, when they're fleeing war. We will always do that. But to have that system and to have the public confident in that system, you have to have controls at the border, you have to have disincentives for people who don't have a legitimate claim to travel, and you have to have the right mechanisms that those that when they don't have a legitimate claim, they can be removed in a timely manner. You Alex have Norris. To have those things together.
Alex Norris, Minister of State for Border Security and Asylum, thank you for joining us.
It's exactly 25 past eight now. President Zelensky is in Paris today for the latest round of talks on international military support for Ukraine in its war against Russia. He'll meet President Macron and try to build on the support from the last meeting of the Coalition of the Willing. But his appeals for continuing international financing come against the backdrop of a corruption scandal in Ukraine, with government figures accused by the country's internal anti-corruption bureau of funneling money out of the energy sector, around $100 million. Of it in total. I've been speaking to the historian and author Anne Applebaum about what that means.
I think it's very important to remember that the corruption has been exposed by a branch of the Ukrainian state. In other words, by the Ukrainian Anti-Corruption Agency, which has an enormous amount of popular support. It's part of the government. It's not as if it's come from outside or come from some unknown place. And what they say they found is a network of people, including some senior ministers in the government, who have essentially been taking kickbacks from government contracts. It might go farther than that, but for the moment, that's what they've discovered.
And obviously, at the moment, particularly when foreign money is being channeled to Ukraine, that causes concern. How is that affected in this case?
So first of all, right now, there is no foreign money affected. Second of all, there's no humanitarian aid money affected. Thirdly, as I said, the Ukrainian state is the body that has uncovered this. And so anybody who's giving money to Ukraine can feel confident now, actually, that there's a part of the Ukrainian state that is looking out for, you know, for corruption.
Do you think this will have any impact, Anne, on countries, particularly European countries, that are sending money to Ukraine, that are investing in things like the weapons industry there? I hear what you're saying about foreign money not being included at the moment, but will that make them nervous about investing in that way?
I mean, again, a lot of foreign money, which is given in different ways, is very carefully audited. It's not going through the same channels that we're talking about right now. But yeah, I think actually Western countries or any countries who are investing in Ukraine should feel confident that the Ukrainians are capable of exposing corruption themselves.
Could it provide an excuse for countries like the US, who've been at times, particularly under President Trump, reluctant in their financial support of Ukraine?
Look, if somebody would like to find a reason not to support Ukraine, they have many ways to do it. I'm not sure you would need this incident as a reason. I mean, the fundamental reasons to support Ukraine remain the same as they were before. Europeans are supporting Ukraine because if they don't, they will be fighting the Russians themselves rather than having the Ukrainians do it. And the political and the economic and the security reasons for supporting Ukraine are all unchanged.
And what about President Zelensky himself? How much does he now need to be a figurehead and to own this?
So far, what he has done has said that he wants the investigations to continue, even though they have touched some people who've been quite close to him in the past. I mean, I can't predict what will happen in the future, but up to this moment, he's supported the work of the Anti-Corruption Bureau.
Anne Applebaum, really interesting to get your insight. Thank you for joining us. There's also been a report in the last hour or so from Donald Tusk, the Polish Prime Minister, confirming that an explosion which destroyed part of the railway line between Warsaw and Lublin yesterday was the result of sabotage. Now, this is notable because further along that line is the route into Ukraine. It is a key corridor for aid deliveries. Some weapons get in that way as well. Warsaw has warned that the strategic role that it has in supporting Kyiv makes it a potential target for hostile actions. So while they are looking into it, and it is a developing story, it's notable that that has happened there, and eyes are turning towards Moscow, even though Russia has repeatedly denied involvement in sabotage operations on Polish soil before. It's one to watch.
Yeah, interesting. 29 minutes past eight. Time for the sport now with Mike.
Nick, thank you. Cricket fans getting very excited because Ashes Week is here. There are less than 4 days to go now until the first test between Australia and England starts in the early hours of Friday morning. And as we continue our build-up to Perth, a rare chance now to hear from someone inside the England camp hoping to give the tourists a key psychological edge in this series. Gilbert Anoka is a sports psychologist from New Zealand who's credited with helping turn the All Blacks into back-to-back rugby world champions in the 2010s. He's now been hired by the ECB to help England mentally prepare to face Australia. Now, there are many big psychological moments of an Ashes tour. For example, the very first ball of the series, a moment that in recent series down under has had some rather painful memories for England.
And the 2021-22 Ashes is about to get underway with Rory Burns facing the first ball from Mitchell Starc. In he goes, and the first ball, he bowls him! He's bowling first ball! What an absolutely shattering start.
Not every moment in time is equal. You know, like the first ball of an Ashes test is not equal to one mid-session of the morning or afternoon session. There's more weight on that moment, and we just want people to free themselves of the tension, have a structure or a system that allows them to direct their attention to where it needs to be. And if you're a batsman, that's on the ball. And if you're a bowler, you'll have a target and something you want to achieve. So no escaping the tension, but just getting excited and often reminding yourself, where would you want to be? And I want to be the person that faces that first ball in an Ashes test. When your mindset is directed with that intent, then your intention creates the intensity that's required to execute well. Given all that, that's still a bloody hard thing to do.
And we're underway, finally. Harmison from the far end bowls the first ball of the series. Oh, my word, it's gone straight to second slip. What a horrible start. I can't believe I've seen it.
Talking about setting the tone, well, we'll remember that delivery for a long time, I'm afraid, if this proves to be one of England's unsuccessful campaigns down under.
That is just about the worst delivery I've ever seen in Test cricket.
And it's fascinating to hear how players, and with your guidance, approach these moments. How much does history, the history of the series, play on the modern-day players' minds or psychologically? I mean, England, as you will know, have not won the Ashes in Australia for 15 years, almost 14 years to 2011, the last time that happened. Obviously, none of the current side were part of that team. Does that free them from the shackles of history, or does people like me banging on about it all the time, is that weighing heavily on their mind as well?
It's part of the landscape. You never rise above the opinion you have of yourself. And the good experiences and bad experiences that we have, it's the bad ones that tend to stick to us like Velcros, and they're harder to shake. They become shackles. You know, we work hard with the players to look at those things that have happened in the past. You can't change that. All we can do is change what's ahead of us. And if you keep tripping over what's behind you, then you will fall over. And we look at it with open eyes and clear minds, extract lessons from it. You know, we understand that, you know, we're not going to win all the moments, but we want to win the critical ones. And once you extract the lessons, then we want people to be present, to be where their feet are. Presence is power in sport. So look at the past, learn from the past, and then develop a strength of ability to stay present in that moment, just to deal with what's happening right now, because that's all that you can control. You know, to be honest, you take control in an Ashes series by winning one moment at a time, controlling one moment at a time. And that's why it's a test series, isn't it? It tests every piece of your sinew, emotionally, spiritually, and that's what makes it such a magnificent spectacle.
Have you met up with the England side yet? Have you been with them for a few days already in Perth?
I have, yep.
Well, what have you made of the players in the time that you've been with them? What have your first impressions been?
Working hard, rolling the sleeves up, well-led, super coach and coaching group, a captain that's driven, senior players that are driven. And so they're doing all the things at this moment in time to get themselves ready for a script that'll unfold and a chapter that they will write. And they're under no illusion in terms of what's ahead of them, but at the same time excited about the opportunity to play in a series like this.
And just speaking personally, Gilbert, as a Kiwi, as a New Zealander, are you quite pleased to be playing a small part in this England team's objective to try and bring down the Aussies on their home turf?
Oh, hell yeah, you know. Every New Zealander basically, you know, when you pick someone to play, the Aussies are one that's quite front and centre for us, and we've had good battles over the years, and hey, look, they're a top side and wonderful cricketing nation, but I'm inside this tent and, you know, I'll be giving everything I can to the cause, to Baz, Ben and the group, and if we can put together the skill sets that this group has, we're going to be a difficult foe down under.
Good luck for the upcoming Ashes series. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks very much.
Fascinating to chat to the newly recruited sports psychologist to the England cricket team, Gilbert Anoka, there ahead of the Ashes, which start on Friday. And I should say there is plenty more from Gilbert in his book, which is called Becoming Unstoppable, The Blueprint from the World's Most Successful Sports Team.
Thank you, Mike. Let's look ahead to start the week at 9 o'clock this morning here on Radio 4. Tom Sutcliffe is with us. Morning.
Morning, Anna. Our world is now irreversibly online and interconnected. So this morning we're talking about what that's doing to our minds and our societies and asking, can we have the good without the bad? With us are the writer Naomi Alderman to offer tips on surviving through what she calls the information crisis, the novelist and tech activist Cory Doctorow, whose new book, Enshittification, makes no secret at all of what he thinks the big platforms have been serving up to us. And joining them, the journalist Oliver Moody, looking to one of the most digitally connected countries in Europe, Estonia, for clues as to how to make the internet work with us rather than against us. That's Start the Week. Just after nine, the algorithm already knows you want to listen.
Thank goodness for that. Tom, thank you very much. Quick look at the weather today. Largely dry, chilly, with sunshine for most. Northern Scotland and eastern coastal areas may see a few light showers.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news at 24 minutes to nine.
The government is set to change human rights laws as part of its overhaul of the asylum system. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, will set out a raft of new policies in the House of Commons this afternoon. The Labour MP and immigration lawyer, Tony Vaughan, told us he believed the policy was taking the wrong turn and that the government should not be creating a situation of perpetual limbo and alienation. A court in Bangladesh has convicted the former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina of crimes against humanity over a crackdown on student-led protests against her last year. The UN says it left 1,400 people dead. President Trump has urged Republicans in Congress to vote to release the government files on the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Trump has come under pressure from his own party to publish the documents. A couple from Hertfordshire who were arrested in January after raising concerns about their daughter's primary school on a WhatsApp group say police have now paid them £20,000 in damages. The couple said they felt vindicated.
Thank you very much indeed, Caroline. It is 23 minutes to nine as the Chancellor continues to consider her revenue-raising options for next week's budget, particularly as manifesto-breaking changes to income tax now seem to have been ruled out at least. Attention is falling once again on what other alterations might be at her disposal. And the so-called mansion tax has generated plenty of headlines, so does that offer an appealing option? Or what about a complete overhaul of how property tax is calculated? Lots to discuss. Let's explore those ideas with Harry Quilter Pinner, who's Executive Director of the think tank, the IPPR, and Kirsty Allsop, host of Location, 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 who gave evidence last week to the Treasury Select Committee on Property Taxes. Good morning, both.
Good morning, Anna.
Morning.
I suppose the first question is, and Kirsty, you can take this one for us, but what is a mansion?
Well, that's a very good question. HomeTrack think there are 58,500 houses over 2 million in the UK, and Zoopla think there are 108,000. And I think that huge disparity sums up the problem we have. How do you judge what is and is not a mansion? And how do you set a tax based on valuations which change dramatically and are at the moment changing very dramatically?
Mm. And a lot of it depends where you live as well. Harry, what do you think about this as an idea, as a plan? Is it workable? Is it a good idea?
I think it's a really positive idea and would be a step in the right direction. The system we have at the moment is completely outdated. It's based on valuations from 1991. And obviously since then, property prices have increased significantly and differently across the country. And it's also really unfair. It's regressive. So, for example, you might have a house in London worth millions that's taxed at the same the same level and therefore a lower rate vis-a-vis the price of that house than a family home in the north, and so this change would be about trying to make sure that the system is fairer, that people pay their fair share, and that those with more valuable assets are contributing fairly to the cost of society, of public services, etc.
I think a lot of people agree that the system is a bit out of date now, but Kirsty, is this the right way to change it?
Well, I think what Harry's talking about is council tax, and yeah. I would completely agree with him. It is totally unfair. I pay the same council tax as a taxi driver in Edinburgh, I recently discovered. So that's council tax needs to be dealt with. There are various proposals. Some very eminent economists, people like Tim Loinig, have come up with good plans to do that. A mansion tax, a painful tax to give Rachel Reeves some political cover in the budget, is not a good idea, because what is happening is that the top end of the property market is completely, it's stopped. It's literally stopped. And people are going out of business. Fard Earth, a popular but expensive tile company with 20 shops that made artisanal tiles for people, gone out of business. And small British, often craft-based businesses will continue to go out of business if we ignore the fact that for everybody at the top and bottom end of the property market, moving matters. People should be encouraged to move. It is a huge economic driver. And it is really important that we don't forget that.
Harry, what about that idea of essentially squashing growth by making moving or living in a bigger and better home less appealing?
I mean, the proposals that appear to be on the table are about changing council tax. They're about changing council tax for the top
maybe 5-10% of houses, often worth over £1 million. There are relatively small additional cost. So for someone, for example, with a house of around 600,000, our proposal at IPPR would be that they pay an extra £1,600 a year. That's not a huge amount. What Kirsty is saying is right, though, in that those would probably flow through to house prices at the top of the market. But if what we see is, for a relatively small slice of the property market, the top 5-10% of houses, those values declining slightly over time, that wouldn't be a bad thing. Huge numbers of people are priced out of their house, their houses in London, and so a small correction in the market actually wouldn't be the end of the world.
But there will be, Harry, people hearing you say that, who you say, oh, £1,600, that's not a huge amount. They'll be thinking, oh, it is, you know, it is.
But this is, you know, these are people with, for example, £1 million house. I mean, I understand that might mean that they have to think slightly differently about their plans that year or something like that. But the truth is that the majority of people in the country are getting nowhere near £1 million house. And the proposal that we've put on the table would see some of the revenue raised from this measure redistributed to those with lower value houses. So 80% of households would see a tax cut. Those are the people that really need the financial support of the government,
Is that
house.
The brass tacks a bit, Kirsty? That if you've got an expensive house, then it's up to you to try and do more here, lift more of the load.
I think, again, we're talking about two separate things. Council tax, yes, Harry is right. Mansion tax. The speculation about mansion tax is doing real damage. Even Evan Davis, the politest man in broadcasting, was talking about cunning plans on Friday on PM, which is one step away from calling Rachel Reeves Baldrick. The fact of the matter is that all this speculation about the budget is destroying the housing market from top to bottom and doing real economic damage. Harry is right. We do need to have a bit of a distribution, but the phrase mansion tax has to be got rid of. It is just a political tool to say, look, I'm bashing the rich and distracting us from what we all know is the big issue, which is that income tax needs to go up.
Kirsty Allsop, Harry Quilter-Pinner, thank you for joining us. There will be no doubt more discussions on what will happen in the budget before it's actually delivered by the Chancellor next week.
Yes. What will we do if we couldn't speculate ahead of a budget? It's 16 minutes to nine now. When the MAGA cheerleader Marjorie Taylor Greene demanded the release of the Epstein files and urged Republican congressmen and women to rebel against Donald Trump, he called her a traitor, wacky, a raving lunatic. Well, what do you know? After the rebels suggested they might have as many as 100 congressmen and women who agreed with the traitor, he's executed a U-turn, and he now says he's happy for the law to change. I've been speaking to Scott Jennings, a Republican strategist with deep roots in the party, a former special assistant to President George W. Bush, and a long-time advisor to Senator Mitch McConnell. These days, he's CNN's go-to MAGA voice and host of The Scott Jennings Show. I asked him how big a U-turn this is from President Trump.
Well, look, I don't know. I mean, it looked like this vote was going to pass anyway. So, you know, we'll see what happens after the vote occurs and what comes out. I'm not terribly worried about it as a Republican and as a supporter of the president. I don't expect to learn anything new about Donald Trump. We may learn some things about Bill Clinton and some other people, but I don't expect it to negatively impact the president.
One thing we've learned, isn't it, is that sometimes MAGA tells Donald Trump what to do rather than the other way around. He shifted his position because he was going to lose in the House, didn't he?
Well, I'm not sure how big a deal this ever was to Donald Trump. Some of his supporters, it was a big deal to them, that's for sure. But yeah, it looks like the vote count was going to go against him. So, you know, he's saying, go ahead, fine. I think he still considers it to be, you know, kind of a non-story, something that Democrats are just using to you know, try to tie him up or distract him from other issues. But, you know, it'll be over with soon enough.
You say it's not a big deal. He called Marjorie Taylor Greene a traitor, wacky, and a raving lunatic. And they summoned people into the White House to get them to change their vote.
Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene had it coming, just to be honest. I mean, since the president dissuaded her from running for the Senate or governor in the state of Georgia over the summer, she has consistently become an opponent of the president, a critic of the president. She has opposed him on foreign policy. She has opposed him on some domestic policy. And of course, she's caused him a lot of trouble politically. And so I don't think it was really just this one issue he was angry about. She's been on a months-long campaign against the president. You know, on the one hand, she claims to be a supporter. On the other hand, she's running off liberal talk shows to attack the president. I think he finally had enough.
And how soon do you think we will see these files, or is it possible that they will get bogged down in Senate votes?
Good question, and I don't know the answer to that. And I think if you read the legislation, there's still a chance that some of the files could be redacted or not released. I would point out that the House Republicans did release 20,000-something emails in the last few days, so some information is already coming out. And I guess none of us really know what is in the files. You know, what does this look like? What kind of documents are we going to see? Is this going to be useful information? Is it going to be gobbledygook? We don't really know the answer to any of these questions. So, you know, I wouldn't expect instant action, but certainly you would expect if the Congress passes it and the president signs it, the Department of Justice would have to move on it rather quickly.
So finally, it sounds as if you think this is a tactical retreat by the president rather than anything more significant.
I think that's a good way to put it. And once it's behind him, he can move back on to other things that matter more to the American people. I tend to think this is one of the least important issues going in American politics right now. It's been made important by Democrats who want to tie up the president and some Republicans who aren't smart enough to know any better. But once it's behind the president, he can shift his focus to the economy and healthcare and other issues that people actually care about.
Scott Jennings, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
It's just coming round to 12 minutes to nine. A big new survey of children's reading habits has come back with some really disappointing results. It shows that the number of 8 to 18-year-olds who enjoy reading in their free time for pleasure, basically, is at its lowest level in two decades, and fewer than 20% read daily. That is the lowest figure ever recorded in answer to that question. The biggest drop has been in primary school age children and in boys in particular. So what do we do about it? Well, Nadia Shireen is an author and illustrator, and Jonathan Douglas is chief executive of the National Literacy Trust. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nadia, obviously you write, you illustrate, and something like this, it made me sad, so it must have a similar effect on you.
Yeah, I mean, luckily, you know, not luckily, I mean, we've been hearing about these figures that are very, you know, they are hard to hear. And it's been the kind of the trend of the last few years. So I'm depressingly used to it, I suppose, is what I mean. But one thing that's what I'm really liking about the National Literacy Trust, the paper that they've published today, is that let's look at broadening what reading means. Yes, it is bad news if, you know, kids aren't picking up books and reading. I can't deny that. But if we broaden this out and say, well, are kids reading on screens? Are they listening to audiobooks? Are they picking up tried and tested books that they read again or football magazines? Then we can actually start to feel a bit more positive about the situation. And I like to be solution focused. So, you know, yeah. There's no point kind of wringing our hands about it. We've got to look at how we address this. And I think it's going to be, it's a kind of multi-dimensional way of tackling the problem, I think.
Yeah. And Jonathan, while we talk about the results being quite depressing, as Nadia says there, it's important to know, because at least if we know, then we can start to do something about it. So when we talk about, or when you talk about broadening reading at the National Literacy Trust, what does that mean?
Yeah, so as you said, you know, fewer than a third of children now choose to read for pleasure, but 42% are listening to audiobooks. Of the kids who are reading monthly, 22% are reading online rather than, you know, on their Kindles and digital formats rather than traditional ways. So what we want to do is absolutely recover that national reading pattern. Next year is going to be a national year of reading. 2026, the government has named as a national year of reading, and we're working with the government, working with all sorts of partners to promote reading throughout the whole year. But very much the message of that year will be starting where people are, starting with the things they're passionate about. You know, the partners are going to include like people like the Premier League. The partners are going to include people like TikTok. Let's start reading where young people are today. But at the same time, let's also start with the reading and the activity around reading that's going on. So let's say, you know, the experience of audiobooks is a great way of experiencing stories for a lot of people. It's, you know, it's a way which is convenient for a lot of people. We also know that actually 37% of kids who listen to audiobooks say that that draws them into traditional forms of reading. So let's look at those activities around reading, those reading activities that are new, that are a product of technological development, and let's actually use those as reading pathways.
Yeah. And Nadia, how do you do that? How do you take what you do when you write and when you illustrate and put that in a format almost that might reach younger readers in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, look, it can be an uphill battle. I'm really lucky that, I mean, I work in two formats. So I make picture books. I'm an illustrator as well. Now, the actual physical joy of holding a book, moving the pages back and forth, chewing the pages if you're very young, that's difficult to replicate. And that's always going to be important. With the slightly older books I do, they're available as audiobooks, not read by me, you'll be relieved to know, but by the amazing Adam Buxton. And, you know, he brings instrumentation into it. He does silly voices. And what I've heard anecdotally is that from parents is that if they have a reluctant reader, they'll go, we loved the audiobooks, we listened to them on long car journeys, and then they listened again, but this time holding the book so they could kind of read, the kids could read along, enjoy the illustrations. And it was a really, you know, an unexpected new kind of route into reading. So that's been really satisfying to hear. And it does give me a bit of hope that all is not lost.
We all need a bit of hope. Really good to talk to you both. Thank you. Nadia Shireen, Jonathan Douglas. It's worth saying as well at this point, if you are trying to enthuse your kids when it comes to reading, and sometimes as well when you stand in the bookshop or you look online, there are just so many different options and you don't know what they're like. If you have a look online, go on the Today website, our Children's Book Club, which we've been running during the holidays for years now, all sorts of suggestions on there, different genres, funny books, adventure, factual, nature, all of those things. So if you want some suggestions to perhaps pique their interest, that is a good place to start.
And let's go to the end rather than the start of our programme today with a discussion about the language that is being used around immigration. Earlier in the programme, we've heard the policies that the government is about to announce, discussed by her deputy, the Home Secretary's deputy, the Conservatives, a Labour critic, an immigration lawyer, a former Supreme Court justice. But what about the language that Shabana Mahmood uses to justify this crackdown? She warns that illegal migration is tearing the country apart. She says that dark forces are stirring up anger. Well, let's reflect on that with two men who I suspect don't much disagree about the need to crack down on immigration. Tim Stanley writes for The Telegraph, has often said immigration is out of control under this government and the last one. He's a historian, a writer, and we hear him, of course, from time to time on Thought for the Day. David Coulthard has his roots in the Labour Party, but for many years now, he has argued that immigration has been out of control, and that is changing the views of the majority, turning them against migration because they're angry about that. He's now head of demography at the think tank Policy Exchange. Good morning to you.
Morning. Hello, Nick.
Tim, this language, there are many people in the paper that you write for who I suspect cheer along a Home Secretary who talks of tearing the country apart and dark forces stirring up anger. You, over the months and years I've seen, have been rather wary of this language. Why so?
Well, I have written about it in the past myself and said this is how people talk. I am concerned, however, when politicians pick up on it, because it's a bit like when you hear mummy and daddy swear, right? They're not supposed to do it. And when they do it, it's a sign that something has changed. And you can almost feel either greater tension, or authority weakening. And to hear a Home Secretary speak like that is really rather startling. And people can either take it as a sign that finally Labour gets it, or some people would take it as a sign of that is a politician surrendering to the hysteria. I'm not quite sure how I feel about it yet. I would admit that I was very surprised when I heard her use that language.
You, a few months ago, before this announcement, wrote a piece in The Telegraph with an extraordinary headline, Britain is lurching towards civil war and nobody knows how to stop it. Now, when I read the piece, it is clear that you were reacting against some of the things you were hearing and reading. Give us a sense of what concerned you so much.
Well, the reason why I wrote it was to signal that people feel their country's being torn apart. They feel government isn't doing anything about it. They've lost faith in it. And illegal immigration and the boat crossings is part of state failure. It's lumped in with not trusting the police, not trusting the NHS. And if people feel that the state isn't taking action on something they matter so much, they might take things into their own hands. So when I wrote that piece, left-wing readers assumed I wanted to start a civil war. White right-wing readers who got to the end of it assumed I wanted to lose it. People always accuse me of being very wet, and in many ways I am. My chief concern is law and order. And I think that if immigration gets too big or out of control, or illegal immigration becomes too outrageous, then people will start to distrust the state and take things into their own hands.
Let's turn to
and
David Goodhart.
I hear people talking in those terms.
Yes, thank you for that, Tim Stanley. David, the language then, because you've argued for many years about the policies, yeah. But the language, is it helpful for the Home Secretary to reflect the anger of the public, well, or does it risk feeding and fueling it?
Well, I mean, there is a danger of the latter, but I do think that democratic politicians have to respond in words and deeds to public anxieties. And yes, it's a vivid metaphor. It's tearing us apart. Illegal immigration is tearing us apart. But it's also obviously true in that support for mainstream parties is collapsing, that there is this wider divide between the university-educated, liberal-minded people in the big cities and the university towns, and Middle Britain of all ethnic backgrounds, who think it's a democratic outrage that we can't do, we're a G7 country with nuclear weapons, and yet we can't stop 60,000 people a year entering the country. 40% of people in the country think that it's racist to support reform, and that focus on the boats is a kind of moral panic, as one FT columnist put it the other day. I mean, there is this divide. And
you want to target those people, in effect, and to say, no, you're wrong. The question I think that Tim Stanley is raising is whether, if you reflect that anger that you sense is there, well, it clearly is there, whether there isn't a danger that people then exaggerate in their minds the problem. People saying the country's being torn apart may think, well, I ought to be then. I ought to be in a rage. I ought to be in a fury, when many of them are much more concerned about the state of the health service or the state of their local school or the cost of living, for example.
Yeah, I do partly agree. I mean, I think that, the word sort of anger is overused in politics. I mean, a small number of people do get very angry about things, and a lot of other people just have a kind of a low-level anxiety and a feeling that democratic politics isn't working, and it's important for politicians to respond to that. I mean, I think it is true that the way that our conversation about immigration and how to respond to it, and of course this isn't just illegal immigration, it's about legal migration too. We've had 4.2 million people have come to the country between 2021 and 2024, a million of whom are soon going to qualify for settlement. But it is unfortunately true that although I think racism remains one of the biggest taboos in this country, and that is a great achievement of the left and the Labour Party over recent decades.
Why is it not an achievement of everybody?
Well, I mean, I think they were in the vanguard of it. It is now an achievement of everybody. I think a very small proportion of the country, say you have to be white to be truly British. It's like 3 or 4%. But the small number of people who are genuinely xenophobic or racist are emboldened. And of course, it's amplified by social media. They are emboldened, but by the more broadly shared legitimacy.